Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. All right, I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the QA is the important part, obviously stands for question and answer as we get into an interactive conversation about all the top tech news stories. I like to hold my podcast on a Monday because a lot of news happened last week, had a lot of announcements and a lot of reactions. And normally I split my podcast into sort of, you know, heavier news and specific gadget conversations. And as we get into that gadget block in the second half, I really want to get your reactions to Google's Pixel 8. Now that we've been sitting with this information for a little while, I'm sure some people have their pre-orders in, waiting for their phones to ship. We can kind of chat out our feels on the second half of the year, before the holidays, all the new gadgets that are going to be hitting the order pages. I don't know how that worked. That was a terrible segue into welcoming all the wonderful people in this chat. I'm seeing some great names already. Fat Produce, Copa Cash, Ghost Starscream, Jimmy Fire Dragon, Nick Fell, ER1980, Dave Burns gets an early wop. Juan doesn't have a soundboard. Fanfare of Glory, he is subscribed with Prime over on the Twitch for 37 months. Dave, I think I missed our 3-year anniversary. What is the appropriate gift to give someone on their 3rd year anniversary? Well, thank you for supporting the podcast. Thank you for continuing to stick with the show. Ron Guido, Nick Fell. I'm off my script here. Barry Johnson, Ciense, saying good morning, and of course Bionic Scoop with Bryant Billing. Also saying hello to everybody. Hello, everybody. Got Steve Pogue saying, yo. We got Stiggy Man. I don't know what kind of creature that is. I can barely see the little emoji in this right now. Fat Produce. Discord now has soundboard capabilities. It's glorious when in conversations in Baldur's Gate 3 with friends. I'm sure Discord does, but I don't run my show through Discord. The setup for the podcast is so convoluted, and like the audio in and out of multiple web apps and then pieces of hardware. What I need to do is just plug a soundboard into the audio chain in some way. But I also like staying wireless, so I'm not sure exactly how to do that. Dave Burns, beratement. Beratement is the gift. Apparently for your 3rd year anniversary, you are to berate your loved one. Simon says Hypno leather anniversary for Juan and Dave. Oh my. Oh my. So we've got a jam-packed, news-heavy show. I purposely am leaving the gadget side of this a little bit more open. We're going to talk about iPhones overheating, but really, I kind of want to hear what y'all have to say about Pixel 8. So bear with me. We've got, you know, I got to do some housekeeping. We got to talk about the stuff that I actually managed to publish. Oh, it's such an accomplishment these days when you finish something and send it out now. there's so much work involved. I'm like, even just putting the show together is now becoming a multi-hour affair every Monday morning. And then also just like, I've got to link it to 12 different social media networks just to share this thing out. So, why don't we knock out, first of all, I just hope everybody had a lovely weekend. It was Marie's birthday this last weekend. So, we spent some time. I took her at her word that she wanted a chill birthday. Like, she didn't want a lot of like fanfare or a big party or anything like that. And I was really anxious, like us husbands can be, like, am I not reading between the lines? She says she wants to keep this a little low key, and we did. And it was a really lovely birthday weekend. And I think she had a really lovely time, but we went out to one of her favorite restaurants. We got some food, and then she was like, okay, I really just want to see a movie. And what's playing that all of us can go see? So we ended up just like on the day rolling up to a movie theater and getting tickets for Paw Patrol. Lex loved it. Paw Patrol is not in her rotation of shows to watch regularly. I mean, she's aware of it. Her friends are into it. She's seen a few episodes of it. But she had a blast. She thought it was hilarious. It was a fun superhero story. You're always going to get her with, like, the puppy that has a pink costume is the littlest, but she turns out to be the strongest. It's like the hero's journey of the smallest Paw Patrol member. Wow, it's not a great movie. She loved it. I don't want to take anything away from Lex. But Marie and I were sitting there, like, looking at individual lines of dialogue, like, oh my, this is very poor writing. But it's, like, perfectly designed in a lab to garner the attention of a 7-year-old. So it's pretty great. Guys, calm down. Control-Alt-Clay is here. I missed the feed. There we go. Guys, calm down. I'm here from Control-Alt-Clay. He says, ha ha ha, my kids love Paw Patrol. This is not one that we ever had in rotation here, but Lex was all for it. Dave Burns, is Paw Patrol the Disney toy commercial one? No, it's the Nickelodeon toy commercial one. And this was a very important part of Paw Patrol lore, where now they have acquired magical crystals that give them superpowers. And each Paw Patrol puppy has their own unique Avengers or Fantastic Four style superpower. You know, like the puppy that is responsible for driving the fire truck who puts out fires can now start the fires, you see. So he can solve the problem that he himself can create. I'm also very... I need to maybe dig into Paw Patrol lore a little more, because I was very surprised by how all of the Paw Patrol rescue vehicles carried extremely heavy ordnance. Like, the airplane they use to put out fires also has, like, X-Wing-style rapid-fire blasters on them for the unlikely event of what happens in the movie. But typically, you would look at that kind of ordnance as like a militaristic air superiority first strike strategy, not, we need a defensive vehicle capable of outputting tremendous amounts of weaponry. So it was a bit of a culture shock for Marie and I, not being as up to date on what's going on with Paw Patrol. But this was critical, because now with the superpowers, they had to get all new uniforms, they had to get all new vehicles. Paw Patrol Tower was destroyed in the beginning of the movie. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler there, but that's going to help sell the revised Paw Patrol Tower, which I'm sure they'll release, and the Paw Patrol aircraft carrier. So all of this was presented front and center. So if you have any kids, or if you're aware of any little ones who have a Paw Patrol collection going, please expect that there will be a whole new line of Paw Patrol figures and vehicles. If you're a person of a certain age like I am, it's gonna feel a little like when Optimus Prime died in the Transformers movie and it kicked off Generation 2, and we all needed to get new Transformers figures, because the old ones were all literally killed right before our eyes on the silver screen. So no more Optimus, I needed Rodimus Prime. And yeah, no more Megatron, you needed Galvatron. And unfortunately, I feel like their plan with Starscream was just terrible. So, yeah. Fat Produce, did they kill Optimus Prime in this movie too? There was one moment of tension where you felt like, oh no, one of the Paw Patrol pups might actually be in danger. Oh no, they're fine. Everything's fine. Totally cool. I feel like toy companies and especially outlets like Nickelodeon have learned their lesson from the 80s action films where, like, man, G.I. Joe didn't really get a proper theatrical release with its ending. Optimus Prime had kids, like, crying in the movie theater. So I feel like they've crested that. They've figured that out. Gormlord, did you watch the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Curious since Lex liked the game so much. So I don't think Lex has... I want to, like, kind of balance that all out there. I think Mutant Mayhem is still the biggest reaction we've gotten from Lex going to see a movie. She loved Mutant Mayhem. Marie and I loved Mutant Mayhem. It is such a sweet movie. It is fun. It's just edgy enough. It's just dark enough to kind of get the kids, like, ratcheted. But I don't think it... Again, they don't kill Optimus Prime in Mutant Mayhem. Yeah, I very, 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 very high praise. I loved Mutant Mayhem, and Lex dug it too. But I was very surprised to then juxtapose that with how much she seemed to enjoy Paw Patrol for not having ever had any serious attachment to that franchise. Did it have an old Yeller moment? No. All right, moving right along. So again, I hope everybody had a lovely weekend. That's what we did for our weekend. We ate cake and pizza, and we watched Paw Patrol, but it was lovely. And I think Marie had a pretty good time for her birthday. Again, it was just the celebration of Lex really taking her mom's birthday seriously. So it was pretty sweet. You get those warm feels as a parent when, like, your kid is excited on your behalf. So, let's knock out some housekeeping real quick, because like I said, I actually got a few things out, and one of them was a monster thing, a monster article that I've been writing for a little while. So, let me kick over to screen share. Everything that we're going to be talking about, all of the links for housekeeping, all of the news articles and clips and pieces, everything will be available on this week's show notes for this episode of the podcast. This is episode 319, on somegadgetguy.com. It's .com. So, first up, I was just stoked to finally be able to put out this little controller review. The GameSir T4 Cyclone Pro controller review. A very cost-effective way to get Hall Effect sticks, triggers, and rumble, a four-motor rumble, in a multi-platform game controller. I thought I had it here in front of me, and I don't... I don't know where I put the controller. Oh, it's behind me, of course. I had my Steel Series over here. Put out a video, just taking a look at this. It's a fun little accessory, but one of the things that I've been really critical about for things like controllers is I want multi-platform. So I've stuck with Steel Series controllers for years because not only do you get cabled connection, Bluetooth, it also comes with the low latency USB puck. So GameSir has a solution now with micro switches in the ABXY buttons and Hall Effect triggers, which you can set to linear action or hair trigger, and then Hall Effect sticks that are super smooth. And it's plugged in with USB-C or Bluetooth, or it also comes with its own little wireless dongle. So I take a closer look at all the performance and stuff there. It's just a really fun video to put together because it's one of those accessories that, like, it's a game controller. People have very, very particular opinions on their favorite game controllers. There's a whole debate like, oh, but you see this Xbox layout. The sticks are not asymmetrical if you have your thumb on one stick and your other thumb on the buttons. Then it's really symmetrical. And then I would bring up like, yeah, but I like to play twin stick shooters, which means my thumbs are offset. and I'm using the bumpers and triggers. Oh, but you can't expect other people to play the same games as you. So it was a very visceral conversation about what controllers are the bestest. Moving right along. I also got out just a quick first look video at the Vivo V29. Another phone in a series of phones where I'm a little anxious about the number of devices that some of these companies put out. During the summer, I got the Vivo V27 and V27 Pro. And I was really looking at revisiting the V27 Pro, kind of like I did the Vivo X90 Pro. I wanted to use them for a little bit, then kind of come back to them. Just, hey, it's a mid-ranger phone. Vivo makes great cameras. This is what I'm looking at. Literally, as I was writing the script, I got a message from Vivo saying, hey, do you want to take our V29 for a spin? And I'm a little anxious that maybe we're putting out too many phones. The differences between a V27 and a V29 are slight. But in this video that I've put out, there is one upgrade that I think is kind of interesting. So hopefully folks are going to take a look at that, maybe have a little fun with it. And then we can maybe also use this as part of a conversation for how do we tell a story? I like my videos and my reviews to kind of tell a story about what's unique about a phone. It is getting increasingly difficult to do that when you've got multiple releases throughout the year and the actual experience is pretty similar moving from release to release to release. So it's a tricky conversation because I really like finding the fun of, oh, this one little feature is cool. Can you sell an entirely new phone that is so similar to the old phone that's only 3 months old with this one iterative difference? And do we think consumers are going to understand that one little difference? So that's really challenging. Getting back just to kind of wrap up our housekeeping here. I did a real-time reaction on new Pixel Day for the Pixel 8 Pro, Pixel Watch 2, and what Google should do next. So these are my actual notes from watching the keynote live. And then for each major section, so for the Pixel Watch, for the Pixel Buds, and for the Pixel phones, I also include what I think should be part of the strategy moving forward. If other major tech outlets can start putting out iPhone 16 rumors before the iPhone 15 has actually shipped to consumers, why not me? So I'm not doing anything that clickbaity. I am actually talking about what I think a strategy should look like, where Google should go from there, and how all of these different parts and pieces seem to fit together. So if you'd like to check out some of my more off-the-cuff reactions and a little bit of rambling, that would be the article to check out. And then lastly, this was the biggie. I've spent quite a bit of time finally getting up to speed with the Pixel Fold. I was very conservative in how I was using the Pixel Fold. I kind of wanted to get a sense of what I thought was reasonable use for foldable, and it's still a very conservative outlook. But I have 4,500 words on a long-term review. So it's the Pixel Fold 3 months later, a long-term review, Android 14, and a road trip, where I've taken this out on a couple flights. We drove through the desert and rural New Mexico, rocking a Pixel Fold. And I've got a lot of thoughts about what that was like. So not a review where I just list out all the specs and I tell you that the crease is still visible and, oh, Tensor 2 doesn't benchmark as well. It gets lower Antutu scores. This is 4,500 words, almost kind of like a diary entry into what this was like. And I'm comparing it not against phones like the Z Fold, but I'm comparing it more against devices that I absolutely adored, like my Pixels. Like my Surfaces. My Surface Duo and Duo 2. So there's a philosophy, and I don't feel we've I definitely don't feel we've arrived yet at an answer to what a foldable should be, or how it should work, or what it should look like. Even down into the orientation of the hinge and the aspect ratio of the screen, this is still the Wild West. And if we don't take that seriously, if we try to act like, oh, well, Samsung made one, that's the right way to make one, then we're gonna miss a ton of cool stuff. the evolution and the iteration of these products is actually kind of exciting. Even if you don't think you're in for a folding tablet that kind of turns into a double thick phone, there's a lot going on, not just with how you make a hinge, but also how do you tell the software to look for those different parts and pieces? And there's no right answer yet. This is wide open. So that's kind of the crux of the article, is kind of examining from that real world, can I use it to replace a laptop? This is a tremendously expensive product considering what you can buy for the same amount of money. It's a lot to weigh. So there's a reason why this article ended up hitting almost 5,000 words. Hold on, I got a couple comments here. Jimmy Fire Dragon asks, did you see Michael Fisher's interview with Rick Osterloh and how he questioned him about it and how he just straight up avoided the question? Good PR, I may say. I didn't watch the interview. I want to stay abreast of what's happening, but I really don't feel, and this isn't a slight against Michael Fisher. I've known Michael Fisher for a really long time. I feel like a lot of us tech reviewers are kind of stuck. Like, there's a part of what we do that is promotion, and you see lots of sponsored videos and sponsored posts and advertisements and native conversations built into our commentary and stuff. But it's been a long time since I felt a good interview has actually opened up the conversation and isn't just PR speak for repeating the same messaging we would have gotten from a press release. And I've turned down a lot of interviews on my channel just because I haven't felt like it was really going to be equitable, right? It's another data point that the PR for that company can say, look, and we got the CEO, or we got this engineer, or we got this, you know, executive out there to repeat the messaging, and it got thousands of views. But that doesn't really help my channel, and it doesn't really serve my audience, and you don't leave that, I think, any better educated than if you'd literally just read an email, right? This meeting could have been an email. So I tend to not watch a lot of that content unless someone points out, like, hey, there was something really frank or something earnest or something really honest in part of that conversation, which just really hasn't happened in a while. You know, every single time the Wall Street Journal sits down with Craig Federici from Apple, you know you're not going to get any insight. You know you're going to spend 10 minutes of them softballing questions, and he's going to give you the sort of planned responses. They had the questions ahead of time, I'm sure. There's nothing interactive or engaging about that. It's not really a conversation. It's a script. And then you get to the end of it, and you're like, well, why did I watch this? And again, I have not watched Michael Fisher's interview, so I am not putting this on him because I don't know. But it just seemed to me like the timing and the presentation and the topic that we're all looking at today, I feel like I'd get more insight into what's going on in the world of Android and Google and Pixels from my audience than from that sort of carefully presented conversation. So, yeah, it's tough. Oh, Nick Fell, it's you and me both. I want a Microsoft folding phone that's basically a small Surface Book. That hinge was cool. The hinge, again, for the trials and tribulations of Microsoft and the Surface team and everything that's going on, how they lost Panos Panay, every time I pick up a foldable and I come back to a Surface with this like really beautiful 360-degree hinge, I really feel like we've missed something special with dual display devices and the practicality of a multitasking first solution. So it's a bummer. Nick, and again, I'm really, Fisher does great work. I'm not putting this on him. It's just the reality of where we all are. Nick Fell has a great comment here. I don't think it's Fisher. It's just what you get when you interview an executive. And that sums it up perfectly. We're not running off to other YouTube channels that are doing a whole bunch of executive interviews to say, you're corporate shills. Don't be that guy. We creators are working our butts off to try and create any kind of engaging content that we can that we think you're going to like. I've made a specific decision. That's me. And that's on me. I am not claiming that Michael Fisher is complicit in a, a Google-led conspiracy to manufacture the conversation around Pixel phones. It's just to me, what do I think will be of value to the conversation with my audience? And if I could have that sit down, you know, there have been so many closed door sessions with lower level Google engineers that I wish we could put out publicly. Because there you're getting this more frank, earnest, this is what it took to work on this. You don't understand how complicated this could be. There's a philosophy behind our design. There are goals that we're trying to accomplish. We're getting input from these other teams. And if we could sit down and do those kinds of interviews, I would do those all day long. Because I think you would learn so much more. You'd get an appreciation for like the incredible amount of coordination it takes to launch a phone. And once you start seeing behind that curtain, it is incredible that any device ever makes it to market. It's like every single phone you hold is basically a failure waiting to happen until somehow the company sticks the landing. It's like a miracle shot every single time. And it happens every year. Even for phones that you're like, oh, I'm not really excited about that. You start getting, for me, it's almost like movies. You can watch a really, 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 really bad movie that was made in earnest. And it's terrible, and the camera work is awful, and they didn't have a sound guy for half the shoot, and the editing is miserable, and like, you still get to the end of it and go, like, those numbskulls made a movie, a whole movie. I can barely get a YouTube video out the door some weeks, and these numbskulls finished a script from beginning to end, edited it all together, and found a way to present it, package it, sell it to distributors, and I just watched it. I need to respect that. The movie was terrible. And yet, I'm excited that it somehow managed to exist. And that's kind of where I end up with a lot of phone conversations. And I feel it's a little sad that we've lost some of the magic of that conversation because we're all so well-experienced and cynical and jaded. And it would be fun to kind of get back to some of that, you know, just sort of getting tickled and excited that, like, I can't believe this thing made it to market. But it made it to market, so let's talk about it. So, oh, Nick, completely agree. Nick Fell, engineers are the best interviews, 100%. True in the car enthusiast world, too. Car, especially, like, sports car engineers, get them going. It is fascinating listening to them take their own products apart for you. So good. So good. Oh, and Baseball Super, my Pixel 7 Pro doubled its battery life after the Android 14 drop. It was really poor in recent months. I'd love to comment on that, but my Pixel 7 Pro still hasn't gotten Android 14. My Pixel 6, my Pixel 6 Pro, my Pixel 6a, and my Pixel Fold. Oh, and my Pixel Tablet. All on Android 14. This one, so you know what? We're gonna boot you back up, and we're gonna see if this is my Pixel 6 Pro. Let me boot up my Pixel 7 Pro, and we'll do it live on the air. Let's see if my Pixel 7 Pro has decided that it wants to now update itself to Android 14. So that was a really rambling housekeeping. I'm gonna take a sip of coffee here, and then we're gonna get into the news block and knock out some of these pesky news articles. All right. You know what? No, we're gonna push pause. Okay, so this just booted up. And let's see. I'm going to go down. You know what? Come on. Start scanning the news. It's Pixel 7 Pro. System update. Checking for update. And you're up to date. Ugh, killing me. You're killing me, Smalls. You're killing me. All right. Oh, Baseball Super, I haven't really had a chance to use my Pixel 6 Pro much, but it got the Android 14 update, and I don't know, my Pixel 7 Pro is going to be goofy like this. I'm going to go back and throw my SIM card into the Pixel 6 Pro for a bit. Okay, so getting into the news block, like I said, all of the links for all of our articles, all of our conversation points, going to be on the show notes, somegadgetguy.com, this week's podcast blog post. I want to start off with some Elon Musk and Twitter news. Let me get this. Oh, whoops, I still have that up. So if I screen share this right now from Ars Technica and my man crush John Brodkin, Twitter X strips headlines out of news links, quote, it's something Elon wants. First of all, how annoying is it that we're doing this dance? The name X for a social media platform is so dumb, we basically still have to call it Twitter. So on Mastodon, I've taken to calling it Zitter, like with X-I-T-T-E-R, which if you put a bit of a sh sound on an X is how appropriately I feel of what Elon Musk is doing to my formerly favorite social media platform. From the article, quote, this is coming from me directly, will greatly improve the aesthetics, Musk wrote in a Twitter.com post on August 22nd after the change was reported to be in the works. The change is now live on the mobile app and web version, but hasn't made its way to all of the company's apps. News link headlines continue to be displayed today on the Mac app, which is still called Twitter, and hasn't been updated in nearly a year. So basically, you put in a link and a card pops up that shows the sort of title image of the article, and then at the bottom has a website and a brief either headline or one or two line description of what's in the article. We've all come to understand that's how, oh, whoops, I'm not actually showing this on the same. There we go. We've all come to understand that's how social media works. So what Musk has done now is you share the link and you just get the headline image and a little sort of pill of the web address, but not the full web address, just like the home address. So Ars Technica is showing this with one of their links where you just see a little arstechnica.com in a bubble in the bottom left-hand corner of the image, but you get no additional information as to what the article is about. It's just a plain blank headline image. So a lot of us had taken to sharing the link and then the headline is in the card, so we don't have to write the headline in the post. But if you're not subscribed to Twitter Blue, if you're not paying Twitter to not make your experience terrible, you have to now use extra characters to type out or copy and paste the headline of the article into the post so that it makes any sense why you're sharing this image, which is actually a link to another website. So this harms traffic leaving Twitter, and it makes it more difficult to post content on Twitter because you're not explaining what it is that you're sharing. So you need to use more of your precious, precious characters to explain what you're sharing. And it's all ratcheted. It's all ratcheted to try and get you to subscribe to Twitter Blue so you have more characters to share and you're not getting stomped on by Twitter's algorithm. It's a complete and total poop show. I mean, this is so dumb. It looks so bad. And it doesn't contribute anything to making the site any better. I am still shocked and appalled at the number of journalists that are camping on Twitter like this is the place to reach people, as not only is revenue falling, advertising rates have plummeted, and user engagement has just driven off a cliff. A couple weeks back, we showed. If you're installing new apps, Dunkin' Donuts, the Dunkin' app, is higher ranked on Google Play than Twitter. If Dunkin' Donuts added a rudimentary communicate with your friends chat into the Dunkin' app, it would be a higher ranked and more installed social media app than Twitter would be. Because we all out there loving our Dunkin', this podcast not brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts. It would be like crying hilarious if it weren't so damn sad that this overgrown man child who comes from family wealth and had, you know, all of these opportunities kind of just handed to him because he had money, has wrecked something that was a really fun sort of town square style communications platform. It's just galling at this point. So this also comes in light. Here, I'm going to switch this back over into screen share. This article coming by way of Engadget, written up by Carissa Bell, the SEC is suing Elon Musk for refusing to testify in its Twitter investigation. So the SEC is investigating Elon Musk, and Elon Musk has been playing these games with, well, where am I going to get a fair hearing? And then just decided that he just didn't want to show up or contribute to the SEC's investigation. So apparently when you're a billionaire and you're potentially in the crosshairs of the Securities and Exchange Commission, you can just decide, no, I don't want to. Musk failed. Here, this is the sort of the relevant paragraph to what I was just describing. Musk had been scheduled to testify in the SEC investigation into the matter last month, the Wall Street Journal reports, but Musk failed to appear at a scheduled meeting in San Francisco and later gave a, quote, blanket refusal to appear for testimony when the SEC tried to reschedule. The regulator is now asking a San Francisco federal court to force Musk to comply with its subpoena. So when you're issued a subpoena and you're a billionaire, you can just say, nah, brah, I'm good. Word. So I want to use this this little slice of the podcast here. So first of all, read both of those. I've got them linked, Ars Technica and Gadget, just to get a lay of the land and how, like, pedantically petty and narcissistic this man has shown himself to be. I feel like he's probably always been this way, but for some reason, he's really taken to the stage to let everyone know how awful he really is. But I also want to take the second to kind of highlight something. It was also reported over the last week. I didn't pull an article link for this, but just we're watching people try to examine the advertising behavior on Twitter. And one of the major changes in light of radically fallen ad revenue is Twitter seems to be reaching out to some of those really clickbaity ad farms. You see them a lot on other blog posts. You know, the kind of blog that harasses you to turn off your ad blocker, and then when you do, the page is just littered with nonsense and you can't see the article anymore. Those kinds of clickbaity ads. But when you scan through your Twitter feed, they are not listed as advertisements. They don't have any of the options, like the little three button. You know, you can click on the menu to do something like report the ad or block where the ad came from. And if you can't report the ad, you can't block the sender of the ad, and it's not listed as an ad. Well, I feel we are now in a position where Twitter could be sued for a truth in advertising situation. So many of my tech brethren have written articles and, oh, you can't even report the ads anymore. Well, first of all, reporting on Twitter does basically nothing because we know Musk has gotten rid of most of the team responsible for handling those kinds of issues on the platform. Very, very few people are left for Twitter content moderation and interacting with users who might have problems. That's how you push a social media platform headlong into the alt-right. But I feel that's missed one of the most critical tools at our disposal. You can report unlabeled ads on Twitter. You can't report them to Twitter on Twitter, but you can go to the FTC. It's kind of the FTC's job to examine not just the content of an ad, but also the creation, distribution, and presentation of an ad. And so one of the things that I'll link in the show notes this week is literally from the FTC.gov website, Native Advertising, a guide for businesses. The Federal Trade Commission Act prohibits deceptive or unfair practices. It's the FTC's job to ensure that longstanding consumer protection principles apply in the digital marketplace, including to native advertising. And so what Twitter is doing is making ads look like content in your feed. Well, that is akin to those terrible, terrible mock commercials and news pieces that you see on local news, where someone's dressed up in a suit and tie and they're sitting at an anchor desk and they've got chyrons and lower thirds and graphics that are coming in. And then it's like, and here's the health impact of these acai berries put into this health supplement. Those need to be labeled as ads because they are injected to look like a part of the news broadcast. And native advertising is something that us YouTubers are fairly familiar with because we have to be extremely critical and very detailed about disclosing our relationships with manufacturers and sponsors in our videos. If a YouTuber with 100,000 channel subscribers has to disclose ads and sponsorships and relationships and where I acquired this gear that I'm reviewing on the channel, I feel a billionaire should also be held to the same standard as a nobody YouTuber. But we're not seeing the pushback. We're not seeing people complaining about it. And the FTC has to go by the potential for harm based on the user complaints that they get. If you see, if you're still on Twitter, please leave. But if you're still on Twitter, scan through your feed. And if you see something that is obviously posted content to resemble a tweet, but it's an ad and you can't report it, screenshot it and send it to the FTC. If you really want to try and affect some change in this space, it requires our participation. And I don't know about you, but I'm to the point of like, Twitter really should be burned to the ground. Twitter really should be disassembled. They are long overdue myriad numbers of regulatory issues, fines. And instead, we still keep giving them this benefit of the doubt, like, well, we're going to give you another sternly worded warning. We're very displeased with your behavior, Elon Musk. And then he continues to show that he is not an earnest participant in this at all. FTC, that's where we turn to when we are consumers and we're being harmed by a business practice that misrepresents information or tries to sell things in inappropriate ways. And you can do something about it. So all these headlines, you can't even report these fake tweets. Yeah, you can. And you're going to do so much better reporting those tweets off of Twitter. Even if you could report them on Twitter, nothing would happen. It's totally useless.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
So, Gormlord, isn't that what Reddit does too? Yes, because the CEO of Reddit is very much in agreement with Elon Musk, is a big fan of Elon Musk, and has patterned a number of Reddit's recent policy changes on what Elon Musk has done with Twitter. So if you see something like that on Reddit, who should you turn to? We have this organization called the FTC. Nick Fell, rules still apply. So Nick Fell says rules simply don't apply if you have enough money. If you have enough money, breaking the law is legal. You just pay a fine, right? it's okay that you broke the law because you can pay the fine. Fines are just a way to say it's legal for rich people. That's it. Yeah. Baseball super. Juan seems to not like X. I like DMX. X gon' give it to ya. But no. No. What's happening here with Twitter, my favorite, formerly my favorite social media platform, just needs to be put out of its misery. Banks are sitting on billions of dollars of his debt. He's playing stupid tricks with stock and communications. The SEC is investigating him again for manipulating the conversation around his own businesses. This is an individual who's proven that their whims can cause significant harm in the marketplace and in global politics. And someone who is that, you know, it's kind of like in Succession, you know, you are not serious people. Someone who has that kind of power at their command and is not a serious person should not have that power at their command. And I feel like that's not a tremendously controversial statement to share. Oh, yeah, Sam. Reddit went to poop after they blocked third-party apps. Completely agree, Sam. I never brought back our fun little subreddit because it depended on those kinds of tools with that API access to keep populating good content and helping other creators share their content through those types of automated tools. And there's just no point bringing it back for people to sort of passively, like, look at. Again, it breaks my heart because my subreddit was a 9-year community, I still haven't looked to bring it back. I actually haven't really been on Reddit for anything more than just like the answer to a search question. You know, like, oh, I'm having this issue with this thing. How do I do that? Oh, I guess one of the answers is here on Reddit, and I'll read that answer and then I'll just leave. I used to live on Twitter and Reddit, and both of those platforms are basically gone, and it sucks. It really makes me sad. So, another little quick bit of creator news. We've shared numerous times on this show when, like, some of our favorite content creators share a video about burnout or are sharing some of their challenges in reaching their audience. And this is, like, time and time and time again. Sorry, a quick segue. Patreon just did this huge redesign. I hate their new logo. But if you catch the CEO's video about what Patreon should represent, it's a beautifully concise version of what I've been talking about for the last 3 or 4 years. YouTube stands in between creators and audience. YouTube is a gatekeeper that prevents you from reaching the people that say they want to watch your stuff. And we need to completely rethink how we bring creators into the space, how we build the next generation of analysts and reviewers and storytellers and filmmakers, because the promise of social media has kind of died. The Facebook model has taken over, where you build up some popularity and then the platform you're on says, well, there's nothing we can do. We can't keep sending your content out to the people who subscribe to you. Sure would be a shame if your channel just died, but why don't you pay us to make sure that you're getting the eyeballs on your content that you should be? And it's basically digital extortion. It's basically social media extortion. You know, again, it's like racketeering. It's like crime family style. Sure would be a shame if something happened to all the hard work that you put into this business, but you know, a little of this should help you out and keep you running right as rain. So I would highly recommend catching that video. I'll add that to the show notes too. Patreon has its own whole host of problems, but that little bit of commentary, that little bit of explanation resonated. And I have ramblingly said very similar things over years. Social media that's algorithmically driven is only looking at a viewer's time on site. You do not have a relationship with that viewer. And all of the, like, nag emails that I get, like, I got another one this morning, like, hey, you need to be making more shorts on YouTube. It really increases your reach and your engagement and brings new followers to your channel. And all that's a lie. That's all fake. My YouTube shorts can hit heavy, and no one is going to engage with my other content. Like, that's not what shorts do. Shorts are short attention span, churn videos, right? It is just content that is designed to keep someone scrolling through the YouTube app as long as they possibly can. All of that is BS. Psychologically, we already know the impact of that kind of production style, and we know what it does to audiences, and we know that someone on TikTok with a bazillion followers isn't getting attachment and regular viewers looking at their content. That's not how short form works. So that was all a really long and rambling way to get to a part of this conversation here where I was kind of surprised to see Rooster Teeth pop up in my newsfeed. And it seems like Rooster Teeth is re-examining their position with YouTube, and they're pulling a bunch of their shows off of YouTube, like their catalog and their archives. They're pulling all of that long tail viewing off of YouTube, and they're only hosting it on their own site. And so there's an explanation video here from Carrie. Actually, I'm going to mute this just because I'm not entirely sure what, like, the copyright might be on someone chatting this out. But they posted this to their Instagram. I'm sure this went to other social media platforms too. But in their Instagram post, as you may have heard, we're changing things up a bit over here at Rooster Teeth. These changes are all about ensuring we can continue to create the content you know and love, as well as new and upcoming projects. Your support means the world to us, and we're so grateful to have you a part of this journey as we grow as a company. It's what makes animation and your favorite shows possible. We couldn't do this without you. And so Carrie kind of explains, yeah, they're getting a lot of traffic on their old Red versus Blue and Camp Camp, but if they can have someone watch the same episode on their own website, it is significantly more profitable for them to do that. Watch a video, we get approximately 5 to 10 times more value from that ad than we do a watch on YouTube. It just doesn't make sense anymore to have our whole back catalog on YouTube. And this is going to be an increasing pain point in the relationship between content creators and audiences. YouTube has no system, has no accountability, does not work with content creators to really build their channels, to build their audiences. YouTube has now ratcheted. You know, they have ratcheted down to what is going to provide the most value for our shareholders, right? If you read any Cory Doctorow, you know this is the cycle. You buy something that's popular. So Google bought YouTube. You build it up, build it up, build it up. It's constantly losing money. It's such a huge server suck. It's a big drain. It's one of the most visited and trafficked websites on the planet. It has got to be incredibly expensive to run, but you operate at a loss for this huge amount of time so that you get people acting like it's some kind of de facto standard or it's some kind of institution on the internet. And then you start squeezing the creators a little bit so that the advertisers have a better go. And especially when there's a controversy, it's really easy to then hit the smaller channels harder. Yeah, when they make it harder to monetize, they can still serve ads on your videos. You just don't profit from it until you meet these magical benchmarks that they know only a tiny fraction of their community are ever going to hit those benchmarks so that they can get monetized for their work. But then after a point, you start squeezing the advertisers too. And you look at how many advertisers are probably being linked with content they would not want to be linked with, but you have this black box machine. I serve ads on my YouTube videos, but I can't tell YouTube what ads I would want served on my platform. So if someone's using an ad blocker, I can't entirely blame them because I can't tell YouTube, hey, don't serve these kinds of ads. I don't think my audience would like that. If I had that kind of control, maybe I would be out there a little bit more with some of the other social media gurus saying like, hey, support your content creators and, you know, sit through the ads if you're not paying for a premium subscription that always gets the prices hiked on you. YouTube Premium is now more expensive than ever. But, you know, sit through, help us out. This really goes both ways and we can make you better content. But I can't. I can't tell you to sit through ads that might... some of them might even be harmful to your mental health as we get closer to a campaign season, right? Like, I can't do that so that I get a couple pennies from YouTube, maybe, if I hit a CPM that's valuable enough for YouTube. So I'm actually really impressed. Walking away from guaranteed traffic on YouTube, where you have better search and supposedly better search and discoverability, but they're on a channel that's large enough where YouTube would probably be promoting some of those older shows higher up than, like, my video archives, definitely not. It's a difficult decision to make. Obviously, the jokes that people are going to jump on are like, oh, Rooster Teeth, who even still watches them? If they were gooder, then they would be better, and then they would make more monies. And that's what the Instagram replies are full of, are people who think they've got these great hot takes. My favorite ones, there's like a running thread of people going, but if they're still making money on YouTube, why don't they just leave the catalog on YouTube? Why do they have to remove the catalog? When the whole video is about, yeah, we'll make 5 to 10 times more money per view if you just meet us halfway. If you just watch the exact same video with an ad over on our website. But everybody's like, oh, they're just throwing money away. No, staying on YouTube is literally throwing the money away. So, yeah. It's pretty rough out there. And that's what the subreddit that I used to run, Glowing Rectangles, that's what our conversations were all about. If we want these types of situations to get better and you still want content from your favorite creators, we need to be able to find these other alternatives. We need to be able to find these other solutions. How you support is critically important as we have these discussions. And I'm very grateful. Again, I'm preaching to the choir right now with the people that are hanging with me on this podcast, or if you're catching the replay. But we're going to see more of this. If creators don't just completely burn out, increasingly, I would expect, you know, like Patrick H. Wilm, why would he keep making videos for YouTube if he's getting hundreds of thousands of views, but he can't, you know, buy a cup of coffee off that? Legal, or even the drama that's been surrounding Linus Tech Tips. You know, if it's just so much more profitable to float plane a bunch of exclusive content, you're going to see the first steps being just like limited pieces. But at some point, you've got to make the decision. You've got to make the play. It's just time to go. YouTube is starting to show that they've outlived their usefulness as a platform to build a career. If you already have a career and you're sustaining, great. Keep doing it. Make that money off YouTube. Grind, set, hustle, 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 flow. But for someone who's building something right now, There's no guarantee on any social media platform. And I would say diversify like crazy, spread yourself out as wide as you can, meet every audience member on their own platform, on their own terms, and keep your own direct relationship with every single subscriber, follower, because YouTube will actively get in the way. As soon as YouTube says, we want to do something different, we want you to focus on shorts, and you don't want to do shorts, well, then you're not popular anymore. They will stop sending your content to the people who subscribe to you for a specific kind of content. It's that gross, and it sucks all the fun out of this conversation. It's just exhausting. So yeah, Rooster Teeth, wherever they might be, I know they can be kind of a problematic outlet or a conversation, but I also feel like this is a canary in the coal mine moment, right? Someone, a channel who has a ton of viewership, gets lots of regular long tail viewing on their catalog and their archives, just said, no, that's not where our archives are going to live. That's pretty brutal. Hold on, let me just kind of catch some of these comments here real quick and catch up with the chat. Oh, Dave Burns. Yeah, again, I'm not pinning this part of the conversation to like, hey, go support Rooster Teeth. If you've got a reason not to, then I'm not trying to dissuade you from that. I'm just saying the business decision is one that I think we're going to see a lot more larger channels start to play with. We saw a bunch of big channels start doing things like hosting their own podcasts. Well, a podcast is content free of YouTube's direct ratcheting of their audience. They have more control over the distribution and the relationship with their listeners on a podcast than they do through direct video hits. Dave Byrne says, I left Rooster Teeth during the Gamergate years. Totally fair. But they sound like a Linus Tech Tips kind of outfit to work for. It really stinks. Everything need to squeeze ever more blood from the stone. Yeah, I feel like that's probably a fair assessment of what I've heard about working for Rooster Teeth. It's Thexy Pat. I watched that Cathode Ray guy, and he just said he's making more on Patreon than YouTube, plus his day job now. I have 160,000 subscribers on YouTube, and I'm regularly getting a lot of watch time and a lot of views. And with a very, very small collection of patrons, I make more on Patreon than I do on YouTube. It's not hard to eclipse the earnings on YouTube a tiny fraction of the followers on Patreon than I do on YouTube. So Go Starscream, like, this is what I've been trying to do for years. Go Starscream says, Juan, what would be your alt if you couldn't make a living off, so to speak, off of YouTube, or if YouTube just vanishes? So for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been actively trying to break my YouTube channel. YouTube encourages this idea of niching down. So if you sort of broadly talk about lifestyle, they want you to pick a category. Okay, well, tech is my lifestyle, so I broadly talk about tech. Oh, but we don't want to go broad tech. I'm some gadget guy. I'm not some Android phone guy. I'm some gadget guy. I started my channel with the idea that I would want to talk about anything that's lifestyle, gadget, technology related. But according to YouTube, I need to niche down. And so it made a lot of sense to niche down to phones, especially after working at Pocket now and doing some work there. Okay, well, the most popular phones are Apple phones. So you should niche down to app. If you made more videos about iPhones, well, then you would make more money and your videos would get more views. Oh, you don't want to make just iPhone videos. Well, then you should only talk about Samsung. And when you go into your creator analytics, they'll suggest content. This is what's hilarious. You go through and you say, like, what are some ideas? What are some holes in my channel right now? And it doesn't matter what content I've made or what I've put out. It's invariably, you need to make more Samsung Apple videos. That's the only thing this analytics tool has ever suggested. If you want to talk about tablets, you should talk about Samsung tablets. If you want to talk about smartphones, you should talk about Apple smartphones. You should talk about iPads. That's it. That's all you get. If you're looking at YouTube as a platform or as a way to kind of build a following in a career, you don't need to dig too deep. I just told you the whole game plan. Just make unending, unceasing content for the most popular products that are already popular. You are not the tastemaker. You're not informing anybody. You're not educating anybody. All you need to do is confirm the bias of the people who occupy the largest demographics. If you want international audience, then you throw in some Xiaomi. Done. That's your channel. You will be so much more financially successful on YouTube than I currently am. Easy. You just gotta find daily content to put up only talking about Samsung or Apple or both. Or about how Apple is better than Samsung. You will always win. So, if YouTube vanished, I would just do kind of what I'm still doing. There are other places to host video. I'm really, at this point, I'm not counting on YouTube to find new viewers. People search and find my content. I get a lot of traffic from search, but it's always like sideways or long tail or old stuff. So I would get that search traffic anywhere you could search. Like, it doesn't have to be YouTube specific. That's just a convenience. So if YouTube vanished and I were posting my videos to archive.org, actually, I probably should. I should re-upload everything that I've made to archive.org. Twitch. I still get regular viewership on some of my older videos that I used to co-upload to Twitch here on Twitch. that would be almost exactly the same. At this point, all YouTube is for me is free server hosting, so that I don't have to upload a video directly to my own website, somegadgetguy.com, and I don't have to pay Patreon to upload a video, because they have a video upload service too, but depending on how much traffic your videos get, I think there's like a sliding scale on how you pay them for that service. Nothing would change. YouTube disappearing would be a benefit for me, because it would instantly spread the concentrated YouTube audience out into the internet again, and I could meet them in other places that wouldn't algorithmically stand on my neck. So if YouTube were to fail and vanish tomorrow, that would be a net positive, and I would make more money without YouTube being this albatross around my neck. It's Thexy Pat. We'll have to see. I wonder how long it'll be until Patreon becomes a problem. Some of the recent changes have been interesting, but I am very anxious about Patreon as a platform. I just haven't found a better collection of tools to have that kind of direct engagement, that direct relationship. But it's a monetized platform, and at some point there will probably be a creator audience reckoning. I don't know that that is also a permanent home for what the kind of conversations that I like to have. Nick Fell, I just don't think that that's as big a deal. Nick says, there's a core problem with discoverability leaving YouTube. I don't know how you would deal with that, and I'm not sure how creators deal with that. How do you find new viewers with only a Nebula channel or Floatplane or Patreon, etc.? And yet, I publish a new video, and I've got to put out 6 or 7 different social media posts and a blog post to promote the video, to send people to watch the video on YouTube. You don't get alerts on my videos. So discoverability is this red herring, as far as I'm concerned. Discoverability would be, I publish a video, and the people who subscribe to my channel are exposed to the idea that I published a video. But instead, I publish a video, and if I don't work my butt off to get any views from outside of YouTube, then that video perishes. That video dies in a flaming wreckage dumpster fire. So discoverability is not something that YouTube is doing right now. They are not helping other people discover your video. Do I still have it in here? I don't think I do. Oh, it's out in the hallway. I did that video on the Ulanzi video tripod, right? I have a channel that focuses a lot on mobile, but a core component of the expertise and the conversation that I bring to the table is talking about camera, photography, video concepts, editing, production, how to spruce up your videos. That's like constantly been a major part of my channel. I can do a Sony Xperia camera video just talking about the UI on the camera apps. Tens of thousands of views, right? That's the driest material you can put together on a phone, is let's talk about the features in the new Sony Xperia camera apps. But if I put out a video on a tripod, which ostensibly my audience should be interested in, I'm getting views that that amount to maybe 0.6%, not 6%, 0.6% of my subscriber base. So you can't tell me there's any discoverability happening from YouTube. YouTube crushed my video because it wasn't a Samsung or an Apple smartphone video, or even a Sony or a Xiaomi smartphone video. This guy is trying to step outside of his lane and talking about a product that is absolutely an accessory that mobile content creators would want to know about. But it died. And there's nothing I can do to fix that. There's nothing I can do to save that. It is game over. So no, I'd be totally fine if YouTube completely perished. SomeGadgetGuy.com would go on and be totally fine in the kind of traffic that it's that it's working with right now. Everything in my life would be better if YouTube vanished tomorrow. I'd be healthier, I'd be happier, I'd have a better relationship with my viewers, I'd be able to take more frequent breaks from the constant churn of production. There's no downside here. It's Thexipat. Juan, you'll just have to push the, quote, YouTube emergency viewer boost button by starting to do Oreo cookie review videos. And, yeah, Michael Corcoran, in a former life, I was a junior talent agent assistant at a very reputable voiceover agency here in Hollywood. And then I spent several years huffing it as a voiceover commercial casting director. So I still dabble with that part of the industry from time to time. But you want to talk about an industry that's been totally rocked by online content and distribution. Voiceover has taken some hard hits, too. For those of us that were in more supplemental or support roles, it's pretty rough out there for commercial casting, too. So, yeah. Yeah, that was part of the history. I used to have those conversations with, like, you know, PR and production agencies and ad agencies, and they'd be doing these crazy expensive lunches at studios down in Santa Monica, and, like, it's pretty crazy how much money still gets thrown around the world of advertising for stuff like that. And then people freak out, like, oh, but my CPM on YouTube is so small. And you're like, no, there's money. There's a lot of money out there. Creators should be getting compensated a lot better for the work they do. But YouTube's standing on your neck. You got to pay the platform. You got to pay to play. And it's getting pretty rough. Clem Fandango. Wow. Reaper Black, thank you so much. Reaper Black says, I loved the Vivo V29, which you reviewed recently. It's a solid mid-ranger. We can talk about that a little in the gadget blog. Let me finish this up because I have a whole bunch of other news articles here, and I did not plan on quite that lengthy of a diatribe going forward. So this is an article that I'd like folks to check out if you're subscribed to the Wall Street Journal. AI's costly buildup could make early products a hard sell. Microsoft, Google, and others experiment with how to produce, market, and charge for new tools. If you're worried about the cycle that we see online, this is pretty good data. Because we start with, like what I said, it's the Cory Doctorow impoopification of the internet, where you start with something, you make it cool. Cool, cool, cool. It's so cool. Isn't it cool? You want to be on it because it's cool and it's exclusive and it's new and it's cool. And then you start squeezing the users for advertisers. Then you start squeezing the advertisers for more revenue. And then if you can't demonstrate growth to shareholders, then it dies. Or you sell it off or you break it up into pieces. It's like this constant cycle. No one can sustain because everyone is looking at who can we hurt more to make more money for someone else. And so the costs in AI also make zero sense. Like there was that rumor, that leak, that Microsoft, there was some engineer at Microsoft who was seriously suggesting that, like, I have to be careful. Microsoft executives were not positing this as a solution, as far as I'm aware. But there were internal conversations at Microsoft where some of their engineers were saying, would it be possible for us to build our own nuclear reactor to power all of the data centers that would be responsible for a broad consumer launch on AI products? Your ability to type a prompt into ChatGPT and get this response in a sort of more casual conversational way is an order of magnitude more power draw for these data centers than traditional search used to be. So the costs are all crazy in the red right now. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to get a population of people hooked on this type of casual conversational AI usage to then start squeezing them for money Then they're going to start looking at other models for monetization and advertising and preferred search and all the things that Google is accused of doing in their search products. And then the entire market is going to start squeezing the users and the advertisers to recoup the money that they spent building out these AI products in the first place. So the Wall Street Journal is describing the very first step of this process. Google, Microsoft, Amazon, all of these companies are burning money to satisfy the cool factor of AI to start. That's not going to sustain. At some point, you've got to start squeezing more money out of those products to offset the costs. That's going to be step two. Because I think a perfect example of this is going to be a follow-up article that Ars Technica. So Ars Technica, I have like a trio of Ars Technica articles where they all start with, according to the Wall Street Journal, according to the Wall Street Journal, according to the Wall Street Journal. This one is at least originally posted by The Verge, but Ars Technica has Getty Images built a socially responsible AI tool that rewards artists. And so the whole plan is, you know, Getty Images has been suing AI platforms for using their content to train their AI models. So Getty Images is looking at making their own AI tools that other people can engage with, and they will pay the creators of the original content that go into training their AI. And in the very, very short term, if you're one of those humans who can only deal with capitalism in month-to-month and fiscal quarter lengths of time, that's going to be a great deal. You can go to Getty Images and you can say, you are allowed to use my content to train your AI models. And then you get money for that. Great. I mean, that's the whole end of the conversation, right? Nothing bad could happen later. It's not like your content that you got money to help train the AI. It's not like your content is going to train the AI to do your content, and then later on, no one will pay you for your content because they can go to the Getty Images AI and get similar content to what you produced. You're getting paid a small fee to contribute to training this AI at the expense of your future career. hold on, let me get this down here. How will Getty creators be paid for AI training data? Hold on. Peters told The Verge that Getty's AI tool is novel because it, quote, respects the IP that it was trained upon, end quote, and provides, quote, rewards back to the creators of that content, end quote. The idea is that as Getty's AI tool becomes more popular, artists will receive larger and larger payments for their original works used to generate AI outputs. Ars would like to hear from any creators with feedback on this proposed reward system. When pressed to go into more detail, Peters specified that there currently isn't a tool for Getty to assess which artist deserves credit every time an AI image is generated. Of course there isn't. Sorry. Instead, Getty will rely on a fixed model that Peters said determines, quote, what proportion of the training set does your content represent? And then, how was that content performed in our licensing world over time? It's kind of a proxy for quality and quantity. So it's kind of a blend of the two, end quote. So it's a magic black box. We have built the AI to absorb this content and then not tell us what content was used to arrive at the AI generated image. I feel there's probably a solution to that, where you go to your engineering team and say, hey, that thing just spit out a result. To get to that result, it had to absorb all of this other content. Why don't you add a couple if-then-else statements to deliver an accounting of what content was used to make that final product? I feel that is a software engineering challenge. I'm not saying that's easy, but I feel that is an entirely reasonable solution if the conversation from Getty Images is we're really looking at making this equitable and fair, and we're going to help the creators who are helping us train the AI models that are going to put all those creators out of business. And if you can't arrive at a solution like that, then my recommendation to especially photographers would be do not support Getty Images Endeavor until there is a proper accounting of what goes into the black box and what comes out of the black box. And those creators that were responsible for helping to train the black box are properly compensated. I feel like this is a good solution moving forward for Hollywood. If your likeness and your speech and your performances are used to train a script writing AI language learning model, then you put this into a bucket and you say, this is how much the bucket is valued at. And the people and the writers that have contributed to this bucket all get a cut. So it's like residuals for them not doing any work, but that machine ripped off their work in the first place. So if someone says, like, hey, I want you to write a script in the style of, like a David Fincher film, right? I'm struggling to come up with the names of writers. That's terrible. J. Michael Straczynski. I want a superhero story in the style of J. Michael Straczynski. Okay, well, then I'm pretty certain that the writings of J. Michael Straczynski are going to be used in that language learning model. So how about you just cut J. Michael Straczynski a check? That, to me, is abundantly clear. So it's pretty brutal. It's getting pretty bad out there. When even like the companies that are like, oh, we sued all of these other AI companies because they used our creators' content. So now we want to use our creators' content to make the AI that we just sued. It's pretty gross. Oh, Este Bandido. I mean, they're trying to make it sound like magic. Este Bandido says, it amazes me that in 2023, people still don't get the concept that for a machine to compute something, it needs to be fed some sort of information.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Juan, thank you for the honor of having me on your podcast to kind of let everybody know that I do what's called Engineer Reacts. I react to smartphones, and you can find these reactions at www.youtube.com/C/Barry Johnson. I do about 1 to 2 video reactions per week, all on smartphone tech. Also, in addition to this, I'm actually going to start posting on Easy Computer Solutions channel as well, as he just has so much product that he tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, I need a little bit of help over there as well. So again, Juan, I appreciate it and hope you have a great rest of the podcast.
Nick Fell, this is a very difficult question. Do you think there is any use of current or near AI tools that is actually ethical, using it to build more robust digital tools? So I've kind of racked my brain on this because I struggle with where we draw the lines. I like AI tools that are good co-pilots. I look at something like, this is always the example that's brought up, and I am not blowing anyone's mind here. I'm not saying anything so radical or so fresh, but you look at something like the newest versions of Adobe Photoshop. You have these like generative content-aware fills. This is actually something that Google is going to be leaning into pretty heavy on the Pixel 8, is the ability to alter an image and fill in pieces of the image. I think like that's a pretty good example of enabling the artist to deliver what they envisioned, but with a minimum of tedious busy work. I feel like that's democratizing. I feel like that's empowering. where we draw the line on what tools are acceptable, because I feel the Pixel 8 steps over that line on things like, hey, you can now just take something out of an image and move it completely to another part of the image. That's no longer a photo. That's some kind of digital manipulation art piece, but it's not an accurate representation of the thing that happened in that moment. And that's me getting a little journalistic about it, but it's a very freaky idea that now our smartphone photos are even more unreliable in a legal sense. There's going to be a court case very quickly following the launch of the Pixel 8 where someone's going to make the argument that AI image manipulation has altered this evidence, and this person who's accused of this crime will have a good faith legal defense in saying that's not what really happened. That's not what that really looked like. They had to have done something to alter that image. And it's going to create an entire conversation where judges and juries are not tech savvy enough to understand, well, you can see from this metadata and, oh, and this hash string, you can tell that the edit happened before here, or this wasn't edited, but it was a composite of these other DNG files. And it's all going to be gobbledygook to them because we haven't educated consumers. We're just running headlong into cool things to do with your photos. Sorry, Nick, I feel a co-pilot for the kind of content I produce that stayed localized. Like, if I could run a little helper AI in a bucket, just populated with my content with no direct relationship with an outside source, that would be a huge perk. That would be a huge benefit. Hey, little bucket AI, what's going on my calendar? What's going on with, you know, these kinds of scripts? Have you found any inaccuracies in my documents? Were there anything wrong with my spreadsheets? Like, I would love to give a little personalized AI that kind of access to all of my personal data for it to be the personal assistant that we've always been promised. But I can't really do that and stay separate from the more monetized and influenced versions of AI around the internet. That to me would be a huge perk, but that's not what they're building these systems to do. Well, no. Sorry. It's Thexy Pat writes, wouldn't AI always be morally neutral since they can't have motive? No. Because AI needs to be trained on a subset of data, and whoever pumps the data into the AI has a perspective, and there's bias there. That's why, you know, again, we've seen so many issues with things like the HDR and AI processing on photos wrecking skin for people of color. You know, that is a very easily and accessible example of when you don't train your data models correctly, you end up with problems for significant portions of the population. And when you start getting into things like what is morally neutral, again, the AI doesn't have agency. The AI is a piece of software that is trained on other people's content and then is tasked with delivering a result from the person delivering a prompt. So the person delivering the prompt is immediately pointing the AI in a specific direction, and then the AI is leaning on the data that it's soaked up from other creative sources. There's nothing neutral about that scenario. Unless you had an AI that was trained perfectly on every piece of data around the world in real time and had access to everything to accomplish the tasks that were presented, then maybe you could lay some argument that it's somehow neutral in its scope and its but even then, you'd start talking about demographics, and if there's a that is so big, I can't conceptualize that in the course of another half hour of a podcast. All right, two quick back to back stories, and then we can finally start talking about some phones and stuff. Sorry, every topic here has been a longer tangent and diatribe than I was expecting. these are a good story immediately juxtaposed by a bad story, all right? Netflix is getting Dead Cells. So if you have not played the amazing platformer roguelite that is Dead Cells, one, shame on you. It is one of the best precision platformer roguelites ever made in the history of the genre, and has added a whole bunch of really fun extra DLC content, like the Castlevania update for Dead Cells was incredible. I have played most of Dead Cells on a phone, but you can get it on a Nintendo Switch, you can get it for PC, you can get it for different consoles, but now Netflix is adding it to their catalog with, it looks like, all of the DLC intact. Also, Dead Cells is getting, I'm quoting this from Engadget, Lawrence Bonk wrote this up over at Engadget. The other one is Slayaway Camp. So Slayaway Camp is this charming, cute little puzzle game. It's one of those slider games, right? Your character's on like one part of the screen, and then you've got to navigate to like get to a goal or push someone into something. A lot of those box puzzles are really, really fun. But Slayaway Camp is one of those little puzzle games in the guise of a 1980s slasher film. So you have little skull face guy, and then you have to kill all like the kids at a summer camp, and then you've got to navigate your skull face guy back to an exit on the map. It's cute. It's little blocky pixel art. It's adorable. Really fun puzzle mechanics. It's great. So they're getting a sequel, Slayaway Camp, Netflix and Kill. Yeah, Netflix and Chill. Yeah, see, it's kind of a pun. So both of those games are eventually going to be going to the Netflix catalog. If you're paying for Netflix, you actually have an incredible collection of really good games that have all of their monetization and microtransactions and in-app purchases removed. So like, I've been playing Bloons. Bloons TD6 is on Netflix. I'm playing it through the Netflix version of this. But the flip side of our Netflix story, while I'm super excited to see the Netflix game catalog get even more robust with really, really, really good options, we should expect Netflix price hikes coming after the strikes in Hollywood are over. This is written up by Sharon Harding. We're basically waiting for the WGA, the SAG-AFTRA, and then also what's going on with the SAG video game contract negotiating. And once all of those kind of settle down, we should expect to see prices climb at Netflix yet again. So it's always, you got to get some good with some bad. But again, if you're watching the prices at Netflix climb and you're wanting to hang on to your Netflix subscription, I would also recommend trying to reduce your plan if you can. I know in a lot of areas they've gotten rid of what we use now, which is just the one screen ad-free version of Netflix. And then also take advantage of some of this other stuff. If you haven't been playing games on Netflix, or if you know parents that are still letting their kids play garbage mobile games on their phones, point them to Netflix. This is soul-crushing, where I will talk to the other parents in my daughter's circle of friends, and I'll watch their kid play a game on a phone, and there are banner ads and pop-ups, and do you want more gems to do another run? And they're like, Mommy, I need more gems. No, you can't have any more. You already spent your allowance. And you're like, what are you teaching them? There's like a Sonic Runner game, right? Kids love Sonic. I don't understand how Sonic is the property that it still is today. But play the Sonic Runner game on Netflix and you never have to deal with any of those microtransactions or in-app purchases. Oh no, it's a gem swap game where you like candy and you make rows of candy. Why would you let your kid play that unsupervised on a phone that's just going to throw ads at them, make them try to install other apps, or literally just hit them up for money? Uh-oh, you're out of candy points. Do you want more candy points to try this board again? Or you could play any of the myriad number of gem swap games on Netflix, and all of that's removed. You don't have to deal with any of it. And again, it's shocking to me because parents at my daughter's school are almost universally younger than I am. They grew up in a video game culture. They grew up in a burgeoning internet culture starting to get into mobility and mobile tools, and they have zero awareness of how any of this stuff works. And I'll bring it up to them. I'll say, yeah, you can do this. Oh, yeah, okay, cool. And then I'll bring it up again, and it's like the first time they've ever heard it. And I was like, go to your Netflix app, push games. Okay, you get so serious about all those wacky little video games. And then the next time it comes up in a conversation, it's like it's the first time they've ever heard it. And you're like, I've started getting kind of snarky with a few of them. And they can tell that, like, I'm getting edgy about it. But it's like, well, I guess some parents care about their kids. And some parents just like serving their kids garbage. Juan, that's silly. No, I know. It shocks me, too. But, you know, like, I go to my daughter and I make sure she's not getting, you know, exposed to people in vile online chat. And that she's not getting a ton of advertising and that she can't spend any real money. I mean, some people care. Others, if they don't care, then that's fine. If they don't want to care and they want to serve their kids garbage, then they can serve their kids garbage. Free country. You're free to do whatever you want to rot your child's brain. But when my daughter plays games, I try to make sure that she doesn't have any of that stuff. And then they all get like real quiet and they get real defensive. And then we talk about something else. How's soccer camp going? I don't know. It's fine. Pakistan. One problem. No, go back. Pakistan. Where is it? There we go. Sorry, the chat like jumped on me. Pakistan. One problem. Explaining to those parents how to pair a controller with the TV. The kids aren't taking control of the TV. That's another thing that kills me. It's like kids will pick up their parents' like phone or tablet and then just run wild. And you're like, man, 7-year-olds should not have unfettered access to the kind of communication and compute tools that grown-ups have. We were organizing a play date and we were talking to the mom and we were saying like, oh, and hey, yeah, come over. We can do some wacky things, play some board games, something like that. We just wanted to let my daughter and this family son hang out for a little while. And we're like, yeah, and we were thinking about ordering a pizza. And we get a reply from the mom, pizza, yuck. I want sushi. So we paused the conversation for just a bit, and then later the mom replied like, okay, the pizza could be fine. We'll talk to him about pizza. And then about 5 minutes after that, we get another reply from the mom. Oh, I am so sorry. My son took my phone and replied to the text for me. Who does that? Who lets their kid just play on their phone to the point where they are actively engaged in every app? We're talking a 7-year-old actively engaged in the other apps on the phone to reply to messages. Okay, I guess this is the dystopia that we're participating in. I mean, just. Unbelievable. We could not believe it. Could not. Ted. God damn. I thought that level of snarkiness was reserved for us on the YouTubes. Every now and then it leaks out in real life. I try to keep it online. Like that's my outlet. That's where I exercise all of these demons. But it's genuinely one of those things like people will look at us weird if we don't let my daughter just go hog wild on Roblox. Like, somehow we're the freaks, right? It's almost kind of like, you know, wearing a mask in public now. Like, oh, COVID is over. It's weird. It's like, I've made poor decisions raising my child with this kind of electronic content. So now I'm going to react hostile to the idea of someone trying to not do the same thing that I've done. And that's the kind of energy you get in a lot of these parent interactions. Like, it's weird that I care so much what my daughter consumes. It's just video games. And you're right. It's just video games. So why would you be okay with your kid consuming this kind of content? I mean, you don't sit your 7-year-old down in front of, like, Saw films. Why is that? Oh, because some of the content there is inappropriate for a younger viewer. Interesting. Okay. So I've started letting some of that kind of gurgle out a bit. And it's not great, but I do have some fun with watching them eventually kind of get backed into a corner where they have nowhere else to go. Again, it's exactly what I do on my YouTube with like Samsung Nights. You get to a point in a conversation where it's like, I brought the receipts. Unless you've got some piece of data that is overwhelmingly more compelling than the entire litany of complaints that I have with this company, then our conversation is ended. And they always come back at that point with like, I mean, you're not wrong, but your tone is so problematic. And if you just had a better tone, then more people would listen to what you have to say. And it's your tone. I've clutched all of my pearls because of your tone. Oh, yeah. Pacostin, kids spending $100 in Farmville wouldn't even be a blip now. I mean, when you look at the whales on some of these mobile games, like, I got burnt out on Marvel Future Fight. I loved Future Fight. And once they started doing new tiers and some of their bigger community roster events, you just saw immediately how ratcheted that game was to squeezing money out of the whales. And you would see some of these teams go up in the online play, in the, what are they called? The guild versus guild competitions in Marvel Future Fight. And the only way you could have been going up against the characters that they had were if every single member in, like, I think they were 20-person guilds. I forget how many people were in a guild. But if every person in that guild had spent tens of thousands of dollars a month keeping up with all of the meta characters of that game. And there weren't very many guilds at the top of that pipeline, but those who were constantly outranking the rest of the player base, that's the kind of money that they were spending on Marvel Future Fight. So some kid spending $100 in Farmville, not on my radar. Not even close. So, yeah. Brian Glaze, quote, your boundaries should be my boundaries. Duh, Juan. Love it. Love it. Yeah, they get real persnickety about stuff like that. So who wants to talk about iPhones overheating? Apparently, Apple has pushed out an update. It's iOS 17.0.3 that is helping to alleviate some of the issues with iPhones overheating on apps like Instagram. And also, it addresses a pair of security exploits that, again, may or may not have been exploited out in the wild. Apple is miserable at actually telling their own customers when there was a problem with one of their products that might have led their users to be sort of out in the wild. But yeah, so apparently we see these little minor bug fixes and patches, and they seem to have helped. So if you were getting iPhone Hot Pocket just on using Instagram or something more basic social media, so one of the other people were saying that like the Notes app on iOS was also causing some of this behavior as well. Just something was happening where the app was not properly talking to the operating system and was running the phone full power, right? So that should hopefully be improved, should be updated. But I still feel we've got a fundamental problem with how powerful these mobile devices are and how the manufacturing around that and the optimization around that and the software around that really isn't delivering a better consumer experience. So I'm not often the biggest fan of... Oh, wait, let me refresh this so I can get back to the thumbnail. I'm not always the biggest fan of like overly architected speed ramp benchmarking kinds of tests. Like, for me, it's very difficult to arrive at a conversation about what should you expect from the phone the way you use your phone when, you know, like those app opening tests are garbage. They don't tell you anything about the operation of a phone. All you're testing is whether or not an app can live in RAM. That doesn't contribute to the consumer experience. But beyond just Antutu or Geekbench, we can look at some demonstrations. So take this one with a pretty big rock of salt, because again, this in no way, shape, or form reflects real-world use, but the channel In-Depth Tech Reviews has pitted the iPhone 15 Pro Max versus the S23 Ultra in what they call their heavy workload test. And this is where they are doing like a conference where they're screen sharing, and that's uploading over a 5G data connection. So it's not even over Wi-Fi, it's over 5G. They're maxing out the screen brightness. They're running some other task. I think it's like streaming a video while they're also playing a racing game. And then they time how long the phone can sustain that performance, when the screen starts dimming, and when they start seeing the game performance degrade. So neither the Galaxy or the iPhone do a good job of screen sharing. Like, if you were watching the screen share, say they were streaming to Twitch or something like that, like, the frame rate is miserable. It's a terrible experience for that kind of viewership. But the Galaxy significantly outlasts the iPhone for screen brightness. And then near the end of the test, where they try to do this, I want to say for up to something like 30 minutes. No, not at 30 minutes. It's something like at 10 minutes, the iPhone 15 Pro Max has not only noticeably dimmed its screen over the S23 Ultra, but also the frame rate has dropped significantly. So playback is really, really stuttery. But you get to the end of the half hour, and while the Galaxy dimms its screen, it's playing the game at full speed. Like, it never really backs off the performance of the game. It's just, we have to expect after a half hour of all of this heavy lifting and doing this all on a 5G data connection that it can't sustain the screen brightness for that entire demonstration. You're probably not going to use your phone that way. But I think this speaks to some of the concerns that we've been seeing since the iPhone 11, is that Apple does this thing where they put out new features or a higher tier performance, but they really haven't engineered the phone to make better use of that one component. So it's like taking a little commuter car and dumping a massive turbocharged engine in it. Did you upgrade the fuel tank? Did you upgrade the radiator? Did you upgrade the suspension and the brakes? No, you just dumped a huge engine in a little car. It's going to get better at one thing, like driving faster in a straight line, but then it's going to be way worse for everything else. When we went from the iPhone 11 to the iPhone 12, they added a more powerful SoC and 5G to the same size battery. Well, wouldn't you know it, that was a worse experience for consumers out there. And it took the iPhone 13 to fix what the iPhone 12 broke. Now, if you only listened to iPhone influencers at the launch of the iPhone 12, well, some things that you can do to manage that, you can disable your 5G when you need better battery life, but you never would have gotten the insight on things like throttling. iPhones throttled pretty significantly going from the 11 to the 12. Anand Tech did this great breakdown. If you had an iPhone 11, it could sustain higher frame rates in video games than the iPhone 12 could. But where was that conversation from the more mainstream tech influencers? That never broke through. And every time we bring up these issues, again, it's like iPhone owners are hearing this stuff for the very first time. Going from the iPhone 13 to the 14 wasn't an upgrade. It had another one of these effects where the iPhone 13 got the bigger battery. It's still the crown jewel in terms of battery life for a lot of these like heavier use or multi-day scenarios. The iPhone 14 and the iPhone 15 didn't get better. And a major part of this seems to be Apple's design is heavily influenced by their aesthetic, but Apple has not addressed things like the increasing thermal load. I think Apple was hoping, we're going to do a die shrink. It's the new 3-nanometer chip. It's a smaller chip, so it's going to use less power. So we can find these 10 to 15% improvements to CPU and GPU compute scores, but that's fine for a short little benchmark. You're not going to want to play really robust AAA games like Resident Evil on an iPhone if you can't cool the iPhone. if it heat soaks, and then your frame rate drops. So it's technically powerful enough to really run those games hard. And those games are going to be full priced AAA games. Like Resident Evil is going to drop for like $60 on the Apple App Store. But we didn't really make the phone better for that sustained use, because we know the vast majority of iPhone owners are never going to scratch the surface on what that chip is really capable of. We impressed them that the phone could do those things, but in real world performance here, you're not going to see an oranges to oranges comparison with all of the things that we've had to deal with in Android land. In Android land, we went through the Snapdragon 888. We went through the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. We've gotten a lot better at finding ways to get heat out of a phone to keep a more stable performance. And now we've hit such a sweet spot on the Dimensity 9200 and the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. So iPhone owners have never really had to confront the reality of that conversation. And none of the top tech pundits in the Apple space ever communicate that, because they can immediately pivot and hide behind, well, average consumers don't do anything on their phones. If you play a game, you should buy an iPad and then a Nintendo Switch, and then that would be better. And like, and that's lame. Like, I was doing the controller review When all controllers are black, they're all kind of the same. When I was doing the Game Sir, I was bouncing back and forth between a lot. I love having this because I have one controller that immediately connects to my PC, my giant workstation, Bluetooths over to a phone that I can choose, and can cable connect to something when I need to. And I can move all around. I like to play games where and when I like to play games. If it's on my Steam Deck, ready to go. If it's on my PC, ready to go. If it's on a phone, ready to go. And I don't want any interruption in the mobility and the location of where I choose to play that game. And now a modern phone, a modern mid-ranger phone, has the compute power to deliver an incredible gaming experience. There are $300 and $400 Android phones out there that outpace Nintendo Switches in terms of brute force processing power. And we just need better games to take advantage of those ridiculous low-cost CPUs and GPUs. Simon says, Hypno, I don't know because I don't have an Xbox. Simon says, does the GameSir work wirelessly with the Xbox? So I can't answer that. I would believe, since it's the Xbox layout with the Xbox key arrangement, and GameSir has done partnerships with Microsoft and Xbox in the past, I think they have. My guess would be, if it doesn't work over Bluetooth, it should work over the wireless puck or vice versa. I don't remember. I don't know. I could actually look that up here while we're kind of chatting that out, since I should have known that for the review. I'm real good at doing the tech and the reviewing and learn more. Because there's the T4 and the T4 Pro. And they are different. So the T4 has a more Nintendo layout. The T4 Pro has an Xbox layout. And oh, it does not list Xbox or PlayStation, but I'll have to give that a try. So it says Switch, PC, iOS, and Android for multi-platform compatibility. But that's just a graphic. I'm not sure what the full compatibility might look like. I'll get back to you on that. That's a great question. I'm more interested how buried is the battery within the game, sir. I did not disassemble mine, so I don't know. Aditya, you know, I just purchased another wired Logitech F310 because my old one is showing its age. It's pretty solid. The bar is so low. Sorry, I just... Pack us in. Any opportunity to kind of tag Google on something like this. The bar is so low. With Stadia's e-waste, it has to beat that at least. The Stadia controller was solid. I'm mad I didn't sign up for it because I could have gotten a free Stadia controller out of there. Yeah, it's pretty funny. Michael Corcoran, absolutely. The transition to 5G is and was pretty sloppy for almost everyone. If you're a US customer, especially, but particularly the iPhone 12, their battery got so much better with the 13, not because of any improvements to the rest of the hardware. Literally, they just put in a bigger battery. But yeah, we're already talking about 6G now. So get ready for 6G announcements coming soon, because 5G was so great. It was so great. Flowtech Wolf, Juan, what are your thoughts on carrying both an iPhone and an Android? I have both an iPhone 13 Pro Max and an S23, and I keep on switching my SIM between the phones. I mean, that's always just going to be the personal preference, right? My wife has to carry a work iPhone, and she prefers carrying an Android for her personal line. She hates everything on the iPhone. It's adorable. I feel I've married very well. But she was formerly a BlackBerry girl way back in the day. And she loved having a streamlined access of communication focused on that kind of messaging first. And she can sort of turn an Android into a similar-ish experience. And everything that she has to do through the Apple system of navigating her phone delivers a comment from her. I don't know that there are a ton of people out there who genuinely... I mean, I'm not saying you're not, Flowtech Wolf. I'm just saying broadly that there aren't many people who dig on having both options available to them. Usually it's, I really use one phone as this main tech gadget, and then I have the other phone over for some sort of ancillary feature that the main phone doesn't do well. That's typically what I do, is where I'm reviewing a whole bunch of different devices, and then I'll regularly have a Xiaomi 13 Ultra on hand ready to go because I just adore these cameras. I don't like being without those cameras. So if that's the kind of duality that you like, then I think that's great. For me, I don't particularly enjoy Apple's method of doing things, you know, where they put settings, how they organize apps and groups, how they have controls for some third-party apps, but then not for their own first-party apps. They're just as brutal at soaking up all your personal data as Google is. They're now starting to serve ads in the dynamic island. So if you have an iPhone 14, we're starting to hear reports from people that they're getting ads to flip their phone and get the new iPhone 15. And, you know, it was such a travesty when Androids and Galaxy phones would serve you ads in the notification shade, but... you know, it's kind of a whatever shrug when Apple does the same thing in the dynamic island. So it's that kind of stuff that, for me, kind of sours the experience. And I don't like the way that Apple treats their customers. That's a philosophy. That's not a condemnation of a specific gadget. And I have a harder time kind of working past a philosophical problem. Like, I kind of respect Google's a little bit more upfront about what they're really trying to accomplish on their own platforms. So, we ran long. Yeah, JMan150, you know, people freaked out about ads on a $1,000 phone when it was a Galaxy, but when Apple does it, well, those are the ads that I wanted. I wanted those ads because Apple ads are better than Samsung ads, so it just works. Yeah, Kenox, I really don't get this. Kenox says, same here, iPhone for work, Android for personal. There's a lot of limitations with Microsoft Office suites on iPhones. She can't do anything on her iPhone. It is insane to me that that's what her work-issued phone is. There are so many instances of her having to do things off the phone, transfer to her personal phone, which is a security nightmare if you think about it, and... or actually, she doesn't. She could do them if she transferred to her personal phone. But it's shocking to me that that's... because some of the executives wanted iPhones. That's what the IT department is having to jump through hoops to supply. Updates always break things. She's constantly having to work with IT to, like, repair connections to vital services. Like, it is not a good experience. But... if you're someone who's into the iPhone camp, then you're familiar with all of the pain points and you just live with it. You don't question it because Apple's were the bestest. So if I leave Apple, then other problems will be worse. But it's just, it's not been great. So, what we were going to do is also spend some time chatting out. So I would like this podcast to run just a little bit longer. And if folks have thoughts on Pixel 8, Pixel 8 Pro, we spent the last week kind of looking at the announcement, looking at the reveal from Google's keynote, the Made by Google event. We're getting a new watch, the Pixel Watch 2, and we're getting the Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro. I wrote out my stream of conscious notes and reactions, and then TK and I kind of had a bit of a conversation about the phones on Thursday night's Best of Our Week. TK and I were not on the same page for part of that, where he was raring to go to talk about a whole bunch of features, and I was just trying to break down like what they announced in the phones, and we were kind of talking past each other on some of Thursday night's streams. But we're getting a whole slew of new technologies. And let me get this out of the way here. Oh, geez, Jimmy Fire Dragon. It's going to be a bit. When do you think we'll get the Pixel Flippy Boy, Juan? Within the next year and a half, 2.5 years? I believe we'll see a Pixel Flip whenever Samsung allows Google to make a Pixel Flip. Samsung is still driving a lot of the decisions being made by the Pixel team and the hardware teams at Google, and they've killed projects like Project Iris on the whims of Samsung, and it's going to be a long time before Google can ostracize themselves from the Samsung relationship, but not scare Samsung away being a direct competitor and have the agency to make product decisions free of Samsung's influence. So it could be next year, but it could also be 5 years from now. If Samsung's making the most money on products like folding phones like the Z Flip, then I think Google will have to play ball with what Samsung decrees. Pacostin, is the Pixel Watch 2 coming with a display that Google can repair? We won't know until iFixit rips that watch apart. But I don't believe there's been any specific commitment from Google on things like repair parts for the Pixel Watch or Pixel Watch 2. So I would imagine that it's going to be a similar issue of repairability as Pixel Watch 1, which is probably not super great. Sveticus, what are your thoughts on the new GNV camera sensor? I believe the Vivo X80 Pro has that sensor too. Well, first of all, I just think it's funny because it's obviously new in the context of a Pixel. So Pixels have had the GN1. GN1 is a great camera sensor. It's been an awesome camera sensor. It was in the Vivo X70 Pro Plus. It's in the Pixel 6 Pro and the Pixel 7 Pro. Also in the Pixel 6 and 7. It's a great performer. So I have my Vivo X80 Pro here. There are subtle differences that help the performance of the sensor on the GNV, and I believe this is why some of those new features are going to be capable. When they talk about like the HDR plus video, you need a sensor that can clear data faster, that can get readout faster. I don't know if that is what the structural difference is between GN1 and GNV, but it would seem to me that if you're making the switch to a GNV, that's some of the stuff that's going to help the software process these images faster or get this content up to a server to get the final image better edited. So the GNV was a monster on the Vivo X80 Pro. Like, we're really not going to be hurting for a good, brutal HDR-focused type of device. And with Vivo, it was the whole idea was you paired that great sensor with the coprocessor. And so those two worked in tandem to deliver some of the most exciting low light, night mode HDR processing I've ever seen. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why we'd see a shift with the Pixel. I was hoping we'd get a GN2. I kind of want a Pixel with a larger camera sensor. But it seems to me that they're focusing more on speed, performance, and HDR color and processing and stuff like that. So that seems to be the solution there. Yeah, Aditya Anil, the X80 Pro, that's a flippin' awesome sensor, especially with the software touches that Vivo added. And not just the software, it was that coprocessor that just if you don't know what's going on with Xiaomi and Vivo, you're missing one of the most exciting eras of mobile photography. Like, I can pick up the T series Xiaomi 13, and it's got a photography buffer on it that just embarrasses Samsung and Google. Hold on, let me see if I've got it here on my desk. It's probably turned off, so I'll boot it back up. But while this is booting up, we can do a practical demonstration, and it's something that... Oh, come on, turn on. I hope I didn't let the battery die. So we'll see if it gives me a battery warning, and if it does, then we can't do this demonstration, and this is terrible podcasting. And also for people who are about to like listen to this on the audio version, I apologize, because it's not the most interesting when I do a live camera demonstration for an audio-focused podcast. But what Google is really good at is nailing a moment in that moment. But you don't get a lot of extra tries. Like, you don't get a lot of second chances on a Pixel. There is so much heavy computational work that happens in the background on a Pixel, you can't stack many images in that buffer and still have an HDR processed photo. And Google doesn't give you the option of just not doing the HDR. It's just baked into the Google Camera app now, where the Pixel app used to give you a choice between HDR and HDR+. Now everything is just autopilot HDR+. So here's my Pixel 7 Pro. And I'll be interested to try this again on a Pixel 8. Maybe a Pixel 8 or 8 Pro is going to do this better. But I'm just going to kind of hold this up. And let me get it so it doesn't have screen glare. And kind of hold it. It's still going to be a little out of focus. But this is just, you know, my bookshelf. And let's start tapping out the photos here. And I'm just going to kind of, as soon as the shutter is going to kind of let me, I'm just going to keep pushing. Not holding for a burst of shots, but individual. So like kids running around playing soccer, you're not just going to hold down for a burst of 10 photos or 30 photos or something like that. You're going to kind of take these individual snaps to try and capture the moments that you want. So let's see how many chances we get. Ready? One, two, three. I'm already getting grayed out. I pulled this off a wireless charger. So the phone battery is slightly warmer to the touch than the ambient temperature in my office right now. Oh, that's not great. Okay, hold on. We're going to do this live. One, two, three, three. I got to three and it grayed out and it stopped me from doing another one. Gray, 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 gray. So if I'm just tapping, I can get one photo for about every four shutter presses and it's grayed out. And all because this doesn't even have an active SIM card in it. This was just because I pulled it off a wireless charger. So if you're charging your phone wirelessly in your car and you take the phone out of your pocket, and you go outside and it's 90 degrees Fahrenheit outside, and then you try on a 5G data connection with a super, super bright screen to take a photo of your kid playing soccer, you're going to get two chances. And then the shutter is going to gray out on you until the phone can recover from the two photos that you just took. So this is not a fair oranges to oranges comparison, because usually you can get about eight. That's not a lot. Eight photos is not a lot when you're trying to run down like a seven-year-old at the park. Pop, 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 and you're done. And it's going to start missing the shutter press in between those photos. So now here's the Xiaomi 13T. I'm trying not to get glare on the screen. And we're gonna go pop 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 pop. I feel me running out of air twice is instructive enough. These are the HDR processed images using the Leica Authentic filter. So that's not an unedited photo. That is heavily processed because they also do that light vignetting that a lot of people don't like. It's a very filmic quality. And when I go back through and I look at, oh, let me actually go into the gallery. When I go back into the gallery, all of these photos look the same. There aren't photos in this list that have different qualities. Oh, it's trying to sync. It's going to send up 100 photos to the cloud now. But none of these look different. none of these are because, you know, sometimes you'll do like a series of shots and you'll see different processing for one than the others. Yeah, Samsung does that a lot. You try and take a series of shots with individual shutter presses, and some of them are fully HDR processed, and then some of them are kind of regular JPEG processing. And the Xiaomi hasn't changed any of it. It is all uniform processing going down that entire list of photos from that burst that we just did. So thankfully, this phone is on Wi-Fi, and I'm going to have to go back into my photo backup and delete a whole bunch of garbage photos. So again, I mean, like, Vivo pioneered that. So from the X70 Pro Plus to the X90 Pro, Vivo was the first company for me where, like, this phone didn't slow down. And you wanted those bursts, you wanted those captures, like, getting, you know, movement exactly in the moments that you wanted it with an almost zero lag shutter that just nailed the shutter press. Vivo set the standard. Then Xiaomi got better. And I'm hoping to see Google improve on some of that too. But like, the Pixel philosophy is pull phone out of pocket, touch shutter once, put phone back in pocket. And it does the best version of that photo capture, but you don't have much of a safety net. If you don't get that first moment, you get maybe one more try immediately after, and then you gotta wait for the phone to recover. Those little instances of the shutter getting grayed out slow you down. So it's Dave Burns, Juan just complimented a Samsung component. Are you okay, Juan? I've always been, like, I used to shoot on Samsung mirrorless cameras. I'm mad that they don't have ISOCELL in production SLR-style camera bodies. Now, mirrorless-style camera bodies. The ISOCELLs are good sensors. I think the Sonys are better, but... yeah, I've always kind of been okay with Samsung's photography department. I just wish they still sold cameras like they used to. Does any of your Vivo or Xiaomi devices have external display support? So the Vivo Pros have all universally had video out. So the X70 Pro Plus, the X80 Pro, and the X90 Pro do video out. So far, someone please correct me on this if I'm wrong, I think the only Xiaomi that has included video output is the 13 Ultra. The 13 Ultra does do video output. Nothing else has. Xiaomi 13, 13 Pro, 13T Pro, none of those have done video out.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
Brian Glaze, hold on. because there's a conversation happening back and forth, and we should probably talk about this a little too, about 7 years of software support. How are folks feeling about 7 years of software support pitched by Google? Brian Glay says, I saw that too, Michael. All of a sudden people are saying, well, will the phone even work that well in 7 years? As if the OS update can't be optimized for that generation of device. I don't believe that over 7 years of operating system updates, we're going to see the same experience with a Pixel 8 as we will with a Pixel 15. I don't think that's controversial. It's the exact same thing that Apple does, and no one ever criticizes Apple for it. Is that if you have an iPhone 10 and you're getting iOS 17, you do not have the same experience in software and features as a new current iPhone running iPhone 17. That is super obvious. Like, that shouldn't be a shock to anyone. We all should understand that. You don't have operating system fragmentation on iPhones, but you do have a lot of feature fragmentation on iPhones. And I imagine that the Pixels are going to be the same way. If it's 7 years of operating system updates, when you see Android 19, Android 20 on a Pixel 8, it's not going to come with all of the same features and new services and feature drops as a current Pixel of that era. I have to push pause here for just a second because I missed it as I was going through my photo demonstration there. Muppinish gets a whoop, bow, 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 bow. Juan doesn't have a soundboard. Fanfare of Glory for gifting tier one subs to Tone 50 and ZZZ Farino. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Muppinish. You have been so generous and just so supportive of the live stream and the channel, and I really appreciate all the help and support on this conversation. Let me see. Let's get this back here. Michael Corcoran, yes, I would use a phone for 7 years. I'm using a three-year-old phone right now, and if I stopped using it, it will only be because of the lack of updates. I think consumers with a little bit better education, switching phones is a hassle. Why switch phones if it's still getting the job done? If it's still doing what you need it to do, what we need to do is extend the better education to say, hey, if you want your phone to perform like it used to, you probably need a new battery. And that's going to be a huge part of the conversation in about 4 years. And if they can do that and they can swap those things out and the repairs are easier because of some of the component choices, like using a flat display instead of a curved display, then some of that stuff would be great. I think that I think there are more people who would be interested in that, in holding onto their phones longer, than people who are flipping their phone yearly. And again, I don't think that's a controversial statement. Sveticus, I think it's great that Google is pushing for longer OS support and in return less e-waste. Now, if only we had replaceable batteries. Exactly. That's always going to be the main issue there. From Ghost Starscream, will this force Samsung to do 7 years of OS security updates as well, since they only do 4/5? I think we'll see a conversation from Samsung. But this is going to be really tricky for Samsung. One of the reasons why Google was able to start expanding on this conversation was how aggressive Google has been in separating themselves from Qualcomm. So Samsung can pay a ton of money. This is one of the things that makes a Galaxy device more expensive, and I feel it's fair to give Samsung some kudos because they are engaging in these licensing deals when they don't make the chip. So it's not like Galaxies in Europe get 4 years of operating system updates and 5 years of security patches. It's all Galaxies, which means they had to go to Qualcomm and say, what is that going to cost us to get 5 years of support on this chipset? So Google started what the previous Pixels were 3 and 5? Was it 3 years of OS and 5 years of security patches? I think I might have that wrong. But again, someone will correct me in the chat if it was 3 and 5 or 4 and 5. But part of that is going to Tensor, we should expect that Google has more control over how they broker that deal, over how they support the product. And they have to work with, like, Samsung. Samsung is fabbing the chip, but ultimately they should be able to dictate the terms of how their custom silicon is supported. Now we're seeing the ramifications of that, and Pixel 8 is a significant step in Google showing some confidence in their own ability to manage their own products. And that comes with a price hike. Like, there's so much about the Pixel 8 that is sort of an upgrade here and a slightly different camera sensor there, but one of the things that's likely contributing to the price of that phone, getting that $100 price bump over the Pixel 7 Pro, is we're also making this promise to keep parts in the channel. Replacement parts are going to be available for 7 years, and we're going to support the software for 7 years. So the price of the phone has to reflect that longer-term view, even if zero Pixel 8s make it to 7 years, Google has to pay up front for the commitments to parts suppliers and software developers and everybody to kind of ensure that ecosystem survives. So it's heady stuff. I don't know if Samsung can immediately join the same commitment. Next year, we're going to see a split probably between Exynos-powered devices and Qualcomm-powered devices. And if Samsung can't guarantee 7 years of support from Qualcomm, they might not want to bifurcate their support. It's going to look way worse if Exynos-powered, less expensive phones get longer-term support than Qualcomm-powered, more expensive phones. So Samsung might split the difference. But if they can pull it off, that would be great, because then that would also be putting a little bit more pressure on Qualcomm to engage in those kinds of longer-term licensing deals with some of their other manufacturing partners. To date, it really seems like Samsung is the company that has put the most pressure on Qualcomm to extend support on these chips, where I feel like Qualcomm in the past is like, well, we supported it for 2 years, done. Got to buy a new phone, got to buy a new chip. We want those new chips. So anything that kind of pressures the entire sort of silicon industry to reexamine that relationship is going to be good for consumers. I'm going to take another drink of water here. Hold on. Yeah, so Michael Corcoran, I mean, yeah, and Brian Glaze also contributed a similar comment here too. The 6th and 7th OS updates are not going out anywhere, I think anywhere near future parity than the newer Pixels of the time. That's already true if you have a Pixel 6 versus a Pixel 7 versus a Pixel 8. I think what's kind of troubling to me, and I think what we're kind of dancing around here, is how lopsided that conversation always seems to be. Samsung phones hold up to the letter of their commitments and longer-term software support, but rarely at the same frequency. So once you start getting into like year three of owning a Galaxy, often you'll get shifted to a bi-monthly or a quarterly, or sometimes even, a half-year update strategy. So they pitch, you're going to get 5 years of support. Well, in year four, it's not going to be like it was in year three, which is not as frequent as it was in year two. And that claim never really gets assessed, right? You might go 6 months. It's still good. It's still preferable that you get updates even on a longer timetable, but it's not the same as what you were getting when you bought the phone brand new. And I think techies start believing their own BS, like, well, Samsung's giving you 5 years of support, and look, I got all these updates to One UI in like the first month that I own the phone. It's always going to be like that forever. And that absolutely doesn't track. For iPhones, it's you start losing significant feature parity after your second year of software support on an iPhone. Or if you're unlucky on an iPhone like I was with the iPhone XS, then you're just completely ignored for a whole bunch of new features into a major operating system update kind of catches you up, but still leaves you behind. Like, I'll never forgive Apple for the iPhone XS being this like stepchild to the rest of the phones out there. It never got updated or improved capabilities for nighttime photography. It was one of the last phones to get the revised UI on the new camera interface. They completely devalued like force pressing. That, you know, the iPhone XS had that great like force screen press interaction that just became a long press in software, and then they kind of brought it back, but then not really because it was already deprecated across the rest of the iPhone line. The iPhone XS was miserable for how it was supported by Apple. So those kinds of things are totally normal. But for some reason, you got a whole bunch of techies out there patting themselves on the back going, oh, but Google, that's gonna be different. Oh, I don't know that we can trust them on any of those promises. And Samsung never got that kind of scrutiny. They just got praise for making the commitment. And Apple is always just held up as this like paragon of better support, even though they rarely live up to the marketing image that Apple presents. So it's funny to me. Out of all the phones in the cell phone industry right now, Google was the only one that demonstrated some uptick in market share. And for some reason, that has a whole bunch of people kind of out for blood on what, the Pixel's going to be a garbage performer because Tensor 3 can't compare to an 8 Gen 2. Yeah, on an AN2-2 score, and no one cares about that, or no one should care about a Geekbench score. But it's again, now that Google is getting a bit more visibility, they are becoming the third place whipping boy so that they can always lose, so the hierarchy is maintained. If you're a tech influencer, and let's really break this down. If you're a tech influencer and you want to make the most money you can on YouTube, Apple is always the best. You always present Apple by their marketing claims, and as if their marketing claims are truth. So you never question what Apple PR puts out. You always just sort of accept that that's reality. Then, in Android land, you always position Samsung as the number one. You will get the most clicks on having a Samsung name or product in the title of your video or on your thumbnail. So that's the number one right there. And everything is judged as a lesser than solution to the Samsung. And then in a feature showdown between iPhones and Androids, you only ever show Apple versus Samsung, right? iOS versus Android is really iPhone versus Galaxy. And then you find ways to make sure that the iPhone sort of wins. If you're really good at this, you can walk the line. So it's like, but what do you think, guys? Which one would be better for your needs at the end of some BS comparison, which is not really informed and is just reading specs at you and talking about one has AirDrop and that's really nifty, guys. But if you make the iPhone the winner, you'll piss off Android users. So they'll engage with your video a whole bunch more. And you'll confirm the bias of iPhone users, so they'll pat themselves on the back and click the like button on your video. It's kind of the best of both worlds. Traffic is traffic. If it's outrage traffic and outrage comments, that still makes you money. So always make that hierarchy. But you need a good, high-profile, SEO-popular whipping boy. You need a loser in this conversation so that you can seem fair and unbiased, and you're giving these other smaller players a fair shot on your channel, and they just can't quite stick the landing. They're so close to being good enough for your money and worth it, but you know, you should really stick with the iPhones and the Galaxies instead. And we've gone through sort of a ratcheting on all these other companies. I feel LG was always one of those whipping boy brands. It doesn't matter what LG did, it was never going to be good enough. The Samsung were always going to be betterer. And, you know, we were just so sad when LG pulled out of the smartphone race. We lost that competition and all the fun, wacky things that LG used to do. And then for a time, it was OnePlus. And OnePlus had this huge SEO visibility that greatly outpaced their market share. But phone nerds love watching videos about OnePlus. So you could always position OnePlus as that whipping boy who just... they can't quite seem to ever get it right, you know? And the cameras are always terrible because one time I took a photo on a OnePlus 3T and it wasn't as good as my current Galaxy S23 Ultra. You know, you always move the goalposts around and you never really properly demonstrate what the product is good at. You always frame it in the context of Samsung and Apple being better. And now, Google is climbing those ranks. Google is making those headlines about eating market share away from Samsung and building up their roster, and they've spent so much more on marketing than any other smaller brand out there. Since Google has spent that money on marketing, it makes it easier for a tech reviewer to put Google in a video on YouTube because there's already an audience searching for Pixel content because of the marketing that Google spent money on. So if it's already popular, it's going to be more popular for search in your YouTube video. Tech influencers are not taste makers. They are not at the forward trend of what consumers are really doing. They are only commenting on what is already proven popular in the market. If you want your channel to make money. If you don't want your channel to make money, then you can go out there and postulate and get really futuristic and try and push the boundaries, but no one's going to watch your content. Can confirm. So that's sort of the drill down. That's sort of the hierarchy. Now that Google is kind of climbing up, we're seeing the sort of vast disparity. I was watching, again, someone that I've been to events with him and we've hung out and I think we're pretty cool, so I don't want to just completely out him. But I was watching his iPhone coverage, and it's so exciting. Here's the iPhone 15. It does this thing in Dynamic Island. Isn't this so cool, guys? What do you think? Drop some comments. And then I saw his Pixel 8 hands-on. I was like, well, okay, guys, yeah, it's the new Pixel. I really love this new color. And you're like, you're saying words like, I'm so excited and I really love, and you're doing it with American Gothic face. But I saw your iPhone video where you were dancing around with iJustine and stuff on social media, and you were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and really going for it, guys. Isn't this so cool? Oh, the new Pixel. I'm really excited to be holding this new Pixel phone, and it does Google things. And can you even trust that Google will support it for 7 years? I don't know, guys. What do you think down in the comments? So, yeah, it's totally rigged. I went real long on that diatribe, too. Yeah, Brian, totally unequal skepticism. Barry Johnson, can we actually trust Google to update their phones? Is 7 years really necessary? Are people going to actually have their phones in 7 years? I'm seeing as how people do have 7-year-old phones today. They are not common, but you see a lot of older phones out there that, yeah, that would be a perk. And we would encourage more people to extend the life of their phones. Say you even make it to 6 years or 5 years. That is still a tangible improvement over how a lot of people have to flip their phones. Yeah, JFR, it's getting, again, I keep saying it's getting rough out there, but it's shocking how obvious the game is. JFR says, tech community is getting more and more toxic instead of being more united, and that hurt, humble opinion. If you can see it so patently, if it's so clearly, and if it's so aggressively in your face on every single mainstream journalist and major influencer channel conversation, I mean, again, this is why people complain about my tone, but you've got to point this stuff out. Consumers are not coming to our tech channels to be educated. We've got bias confirmation for popularized audiences. That's it. At a time where consumers really need the help and really need some guidance, the vast majority of those consumer conversations are being conducted in resellers, carrier stores, and direct from the manufacturer to the customer through advertising. If you look at all of the traffic on a massive YouTube channel, like someone with 8 or 10 million subscribers, and you assumed that every single one of those views was a unique hit, they would be 1%, maybe 3% at most, of the smartphone buying public, when over 1 billion phones are going to be sold. So they're not making videos for these average consumers that they purport to be reviewing for. That is a lie. They're making videos full of these gaps for their audience to fill in the gaps and feel like the creator is agreeing with their bias. And that's the game. And that's how you make money on YouTube. So it's not just to be divisive for divisive sake. It's, I got into this game in 2007, writing in forums and posting reviews and working on podcasts to join a conversation that I felt empowered consumers to make better choices and make a better fit for their needs. And I want to talk to those people who also feel the same in their circles of family and friends, that you're the geek that the rest of your family turns to for help. And if you're not better educated, then you're not doing a good job helping them. You know, that's why I end my podcast, you know, take care of yourself so you can keep taking care of others. That is not happening in our algorithmically sorted social media world of marketing and advertising. Instead, it's what's already the mostest popular. That's how you make money. And I think that's kind of gross. So I don't want to do that. So Michael Corcoran says, if your audience is mostly North American, thrashing everyone that isn't Samsung is good business decision. I would be willing to bet outside of North America the bias is less extreme. I have not tested that, but anecdotally it holds up. And it helps, but you find pockets. Like, I've got huge viewership in India because I love talking about Vivo and Xiaomi. Regularly, my stats are flipped, where all of North America might only be about 20% of my viewership. Like, it depends on the topic, and some phones hit harder than others, but, like, you can find some broader communities out there. But even for some of these internationally sort of popularized content creators, you can't escape the monetization of certain markets over others, where ad buys for YouTube India might not get you as much money as ad buys for YouTube Canada. So even if someone is a more international content creator and they could get a ton more views on a product category like Vivo or Poco phones, like, I get tons of traffic on my Poco videos, I don't make nearly as much money on those. My ad buys are not as valuable in other regions on YouTube. If I can score high viewership in Canada, my ad buys are significantly more valuable. I'm probably giving a little too much insight because YouTube can give you channel strikes if you show too much of the background on how your analytics work. But even then, while there still might not be the same extreme bias, you'll still see a similar hierarchy of what is the most popular. Apple and Samsung, other brands kind of work below that. And that seems to be the organization that still gets described when you talk about products being gooder or badder than each other. And then that lines up with North American advertising rates. You get a higher CPM, and then you end up making more money. So the strategy needs a little bit more flexibility if you're not a North American content creator, but it still holds true. The best way to make money is to tell iPhone and Galaxy owners that they were correct for ignoring other companies and ignoring other brands. And holding up companies like Xiaomi, Vivo, OnePlus, Oppo, and Google as being lesser than options to Samsung and Apple. And you'll make a ton of money. You'll make the most money following that model. Dave Burns, 3-hour podcast, eh? No, we're going to wrap it up. I know we were going to talk more about the Pixel 8, but I got questions and no one was asking questions about the Pixel 8. I know, again, it's like so much of this has been sort of described, and I'm waiting to see, you know, because the phone should be shipping out soon, what some of these updates, like what Tensor 3 really brings to the table and what this video processing can really look like. And so we'll kind of just have to wait and see when Pixel 8 makes it in people's hands. But I'm pretty confident that we're going to see a whole bunch of really early but lazy performance conversations on Tensor 3. And for me, Tensor and Google and Neural Core have always represented one of the best image manipulation platforms available. And so like a Pixel 6 Pro can almost hang with a Galaxy S23 Ultra if you're doing something like video rendering, right? In an era where everyone wants to put out shorts and TikToks and reels, one of the fastest phones that you can use to process that is a lowly Pixel 6 Pro. And you can get a Pixel 6 Pro for a lot cheaper than you can get a Galaxy S23 Ultra. So that to me becomes the linchpin conversation. Is I don't care what the scores say. I don't care what the benchmarks say. I want to see, has Google held on to the googly bits of what made Tensor and Tensor 2 so exciting? And that'll be, I think, a good conversation piece to showcase. Some of these phones are better at productivity. Some of these phones are better at gaming. And Google's Pixels do this. And if you want the best of this, that's why you buy a Pixel. So it's pretty tough. Yeah, JFR, and I wasn't trying to pick on your comment. I didn't feel like you were arguing with me. He says, you are right in what you pointed out. They get excited for iPhone, but not for other companies doing something new or different. That's why it's getting toxic, in my view. I'm sorry, and I didn't mean to make my reply to your comment sound like I was arguing with you. That's not what I was trying to accomplish. It was just more the expansion on what I was trying to say before. We've got a lot that we kind of need to dig into. I have some stuff on my desk that I still can't show you, and it's killing me. But we will have some fun videos and some fun articles. And people have been saying, like, hey, what happens if YouTube disappears tomorrow? Well, I've been having a lot of fun taking some of my long-term conversation back to written pieces. Like, I used to write these really long articles for Pocket Now. And I kind of miss having that flow in that kind of presentation where not everything needs to be a video, right? So increasingly, I think I'm going to be sharing more of that kind of content first to the Patreon, really for the patrons that are supporting like early access and stuff like that, and then bringing those written pieces and those editorials to somegadgetguide.com a little later. So I think that's going to be the switch. I think that's got to be the new structure where I've got a little bit more control over how this stuff is presented. And I hope folks can be flexible and kind of go with me on that, because I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. But, you know, I want to do another follow-up on some of these Vivos, some of these mid-rangers. I've got a bunch of Xiaomi devices that deserve a follow-up. I still need... Barry, I'm so sorry. I meant to send back your Oppo. It will be back in the mail the end of this week, I promise. But those are the kinds of conversations where I can't keep turning everything into a video. But there's still cool things that I think we should talk about. So stay tuned. Plenty of really, really cool stuff. I'm hoping to find all of that fun again this Techtober. So it's not just, here is a new Samsung Apple iPhone thing, and now you give me more monies, YouTube revenue. Because that's obviously like, you know, what I've been really cranky about this whole podcast. Okay, one more. Mini-me 1231, since it's actually a question about the Pixel. Your thoughts on Pixels taking photos in P3 color format and Ultra HDR by default? I think this is going to get messy. Apple does one thing quietly that is a huge boon to the Apple ecosystem. How Apple sort of calibrates their displays goes hand in hand with how their iPhones shoot photos. And it's really cool, but you look at a photo taken from an iPhone, on an iPad, on a Mac, on an Apple Studio display, and they all seem to speak the same language. HDR is a flipping mess. And if you shoot HDR video on one Android phone and watch it back on another Android phone, it might not know what to do with it. If you shoot HDR video on an Android and then watch it on a Windows PC or upload it to YouTube and you don't have the right display and YouTube doesn't know what to do with it, it is a mess. I feel Google and Samsung working together could help arrive at a conversation where we would have some expectations that if I shoot HDR footage on a Vivo and I upload it to YouTube, that I can be reasonably sure people are going to see a good version of that video when they watch it on some other monitor or display. We are so far away from that kind of synergy in Android land. So the way that Google is starting to say, this is the spec, this is the format, this is what we're going to support, long-term will be a benefit. But in the short term, it's like the XKCD comic I love to quote. Hey, there are 12 different ways of doing this. We should make a standard that everyone can use. Then 6 months later, hey, there are 13 different ways of doing this. We should make a standard that everybody could use. Then 6 months later, hey, there are 14 different ways to do this. We should make a standard that everyone can use. So it's tough. I don't know that there's going to be a good solution for it. Until we can, and also, you know, monitor and PC manufacturers need to give me a button. Is this Dolby? I'll push the Dolby button. You know, it's like it's almost to that point, getting consumers to better use these types of displays and get the look of the content that they think they should be getting easily. And it's going to be a mess. It's just going to be a real mess. So, yeah, I'm not doing a 3-hour stream. We're ending it now. Hey, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in. This was a long one. I appreciate all the conversation. The chatter at the end of this was great. And thank you, everybody, who was sticking with me for all of that rambling in the middle about politics and regulations and actions. Take your complaints to the FTC. Remember, if there's an issue on a social media platform like Reddit or Twitter, and they're not giving you the proper tools that they should be for reporting content that should be better disclosed, there is an entire government agency responsible for that kind of interaction. You should not sit idly by and let the platform continue to misrepresent the content on their platform. I have to disclose sponsorships. Twitter should have to disclose ads. So, folks, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. Stay tuned for all the great live streams and podcasts and conversations that are going to happen throughout the week. We've got Gadget Goddess and Android Faithful on Tuesdays. We've got Easy Computer Solutions on Wednesday. Ike Talks Tech, he's like one of the nicest guys in live streaming on Thursdays. Scott Peachy is back to regular streams with Technically Speaking. We've got LaShawn on Fridays. We've got El Jefe Reviews and Nomad Tech Project over the weekends. So many good people are out there hustling. So many great people are out there sharing stories and talking about fun tech beyond just what an algorithm tells them to say. You got to get out there and support. You got to get out there and share and review and be those good tech citizens. And again, I want you to take care of yourself so you can keep taking care of everyone else around you. So folks, I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGG QA podcast channel. Be safe. I love you all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.